All right. Good morning, everyone. I'm going to call to order this meeting of the Health and Human Services Finance Conference Committee on House File 2128. And I hope that everyone has had a relaxing Mother's Day weekend and been able to take a couple of breaths and see family. Nice to have that break and at least for me, very nice to be able to see a little bit of family this weekend. So, we're going to dive back in. I think we're going to have a pretty busy week this week. So, we'll want to look back fondly on our memories of this weekend to sustain us through it. So, first order of business would be to take the roll. Ms. Niedernhofer, if you could do that, please.
Liebling.
Present.
Schultz.
Present.
Pinto.
Present.
Gomez.
Present.
Schumacher.
Schumacher, present.
Benson.
Present.
Abler.
Yes.
Utke.
Present.
Horan.
Present.
Hoffman.
Present.
Quorum is present.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Niedernhofer. Great to have everybody with us this morning. So today on the agenda, we're going to walk through a number of articles. We switched up the order a little bit to start with Article 12, Senate Article 13, which is the behavioral health article. And then we'll go to House 13, House 16, House 10, and House 11. And so the plan right now, just so everybody's clear, we have Chair Pinto's on our committee. Chair Fisher was the chair in the House of the Behavioral Health Division. A lot of the provisions, or not all of them, but there's a large amount of his work in House Article 12. So I'm going to ask House Research to go through Article 12, and then hopefully we can have a little bit of discussion, and Chair Fisher will give us more of an overview and talk a little bit about what he was trying to do in the work that he did. So with that, Ms. Sunderman, I understand you're going to start us out on House Article 12.
Yes, Madam Chair and members, I'll be walking through House Article 12, which matches up with Senate Article 13 and also includes portions of Senate Article 11 and I believe a couple of provisions from Senate Article 1. Starting with House Section 2, House Section 1 was moved, I believe, to the prescription drugs article for the side-by-sides to match up with the Senate. So House Section 2 expands the definition
And Ms. Sunderman, excuse me for one second. So we've got the screen shared, but it's actually not the document that we're walking through.
Right. Madam Chair, it looks like Ms. Vang has shared the actual side-by-side language, which I'm working off of the, I believe it's labeled section comparison. It's the condensed shortest document.
Yes, thank you. And just so for everyone's further orientation on this, when Mr. McQuillan sent these out, he very kindly labeled on his list here, if you notice it kind of at the bottom of his email, he's got the numbered list of everything that he was sending out, and he has indicated which ones we would be walking through. So helpfully giving us a bit of a clue. So that would be, let's see, on his list. Let me find it here. It is number 19 of what he sent out, if anyone needs a moment to find that. And so Ms. Vang, if you can share that one, if you have it handy, that would be, I think, more helpful in case anyone's not looking at the document. Thank you. Please proceed, Ms. Sunderman.
All right, Madam Chair. As I was saying, House Section 2, this is a House-only section, and it expands the definition of mental health practitioner to include a student completing a practicum or internship. This is part of the Representative Vang bill. House Sections 3, 4, and 6 correspond with Senate section, Article 11, Section 1, Section 2, and Section 3. These relate to the Family First implementation, specifically regarding placement of children in residential treatment. This is the sort of alternate path that was a compromise, I believe. So these are the same except for an effective date. And then House Section 6 and Senate Article 11, Section 3 are different. But if you look at the next House section listed, it's Section 5, adding discharge planning requirements and timelines. That can be compared to a paragraph that was added in Senate Article 11, Section 3. So there is some similar language within within that. Moving to House Section 7, this is House only. But the next Senate section listed amends the same section. They just do so very differently. So House Section 7 adds to the children's mental health grants that supervision of clinical trainees is an allowable activity, and also adds traditional healing practices. And this was also part of the Representative Vang bill. The next section is Senate Article 13, Section 1. This adds to children's mental health grants the mood disorder and emerging mood disorder treatment. House Section 8 establishes the culturally informed and culturally responsive mental health task force. This is House only. This was also in the Representative Vang bill. The next sections listed are House Section 9, 10, 11, and 21, which correspond with Senate Article 13, Section 2, 3, 4, and 8. These are certified community mental health clinic modifications. And these, as you'll see listed, sections 9 and 21, which correspond with Article 13, Sections 2 and 8, are similar. And the other two sections are the same. These are technical differences. Moving on to the next page. The Senate Article 1, Section 1, Sections 1 through 7, Article 1, Section 30, and Article 1, Sections 55 and 56. These are Senate only, and they add substance use disorder pre-treatment services as an MA-covered service. House Section 12 is House only. This defines a culturally specific program to include culturally responsive programs for purposes of Chapter 254B SUD treatment rates. This is House only. Section 13 similarly adds a definition of disability responsive program to the same chapter. Section 14 of the House is House only. It removes some of the enhanced rates for certain SUD treatment services and providers. It then adds the culturally responsive and disability responsive programs that were defined in the previous two sections. It also modifies some telehealth requirements and specifies limits on payment for outpatient treatment services. Senate Article 1, Section 7 amends the same statute, but very differently. The next section is House Section 15. It's House only, and it provides a 5% rate increase for SUD treatment services provided by culturally responsive or culturally specific or disability responsive programs. Section 16 is House only. It establishes a substance use disorder community of practice. Senate Article 13, Section 6. Establishes school-linked substance abuse grants, and this is Senate only. House Section 17 is House only. It modifies the membership requirements for the Opiate Epidemic Response Advisory Council. House Section 18, which corresponds with Senate Article 1, Section 10. The House modifies the grant report process and dates for reports for the ORAC, and also increases the allowable amount for of grants, the percentage that can be used for administrative costs. The Senate modifies the grant requirements differently. So these do different things, even though they amend the same section. Section 19, which corresponds with House Article 4, Section 12. The House modifies how the grant funds are distributed by making them distributed on a calendar year basis. The Senate modifies the same section differently by modifying the appropriations from the fund. House Section 20, which corresponds with Senate Article 13, Section 7. These are the same, and they provide mental health crisis stabilization services, a statewide per diem MA rate for small providers. I believe it's providing services for four people or fewer.
Is Ms. Sunderman, is this the Rasmussen bill?
Madam Chair, yes, it is.
Thank you.
Section 22 is House only. This modifies payment requirements for mental health case management provided by vendors. And I believe that is part of the governor's case management reform package. And there are some later sections on that as well. So into the next page, the next batch of sections. So House Section 23, 24, 25, 26, and 27, which correspond with Senate Article 13, Sections 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, and 14. These all relate to the SUD Federal 1115 waiver demonstration project modifications. As you can see, there are several differences, and it gets quite detailed, the differences. So we referred to the side-by-side comparison summary. So the first three sections are different. And then Senate Article 13, Section 11 is Senate only. And then the last two sections are similar. Section 28 is House only, as are Sections 29 and 30. And these are all related to the governor's case management reform package. Section 28 outlines policy for MA coverage of targeted case management services and provides a statewide rate methodology for vendor services. Section 29 modifies payment provisions for targeted case management services provided by vendors and references a new section. And House Section 30 modifies payment provisions for case management services provided by vendors to also reference a new section. Moving to Senate Article 1, Sections 35 and 36. These are Senate only. And these are intensive treatment and foster care modifications. Senate sections, or Article 13, Sections 15 through 18. These are Senate only, and they modify the intensive non-residential rehabilitative services, age eligibility, service standards, and training requirement, and training requirements related to the change in age. Next section is Senate Article 13, Section 19. This is Senate only. This section relates to the compulsive gambling program monthly statement of fund deposits. House Section 31 is House only. This is the Adult Mental Health Initiatives Reform. This is the section that ensures continuing funding for certain regions under the new formula, which hasn't been established yet, but is forthcoming. Section 32 is House only. This establishes the Alternative Mental Health Licensing Pathways Work Group. This is related to the Representative Vang bill. Section 33 is House only. This is establishing the Children's Mental Health Residential Treatment Work Group. Section 34 is House only. This directs the commissioner to develop implementation and transition plans for culturally and linguistically appropriate services standards. This relates to the changes to the rates in the SUD treatment chapter. Moving to the next page, House Section 35 is House only, directs the commissioner to evaluate and make recommendations on opioid treatment program rate structure. That was a governor's initiative. The next four sections are all Senate only. So it's Senate Article 13, Section 20. This is the SUD Treatment Pathfinder Companion Pilot Project. Section 21 clarifies the authorized uses of first episode psychosis grant program funds. Article 13, Section 22 clarifies the uses of the emerging mood disorder grant program funds that the Senate establishes. Senate Article 13, Section 23 is a direction to the commissioner to reorganize the mental health grant statute. House Section 36, which corresponds with Senate Article 13, Section 25, this is a direction to the commissioner related to the sober housing program recommendations. These are similar. The House includes additional stakeholders, and there are some minor language differences, and the reports are due on different dates. House Section 37, Senate Article 13, Section 24 is a direction to the commissioner. This is the SUD paperwork reduction project. These are also similar with only some minor technical language differences. House Section 38 is House only. This is a direction to the commissioner to establish tribal overpayment protocols to try to address any future overpayments that might occur and how to handle those. House Section 39, which corresponds with Senate Article 13, Section 28, is a direction to the commissioner. This is to set up an SUD treatment rate restructuring contract. This is similar with only minor technical differences. The next several sections are all Senate only. So Senate Article 13, Section 26 is a direction to the commissioner to evaluate DHS management of compulsive gambling programming and funding, and to evaluate that with MDH. Section 27 is Senate only. It's a direction to the commissioner. It's to provide an SUD, the 1115 demonstration project enrollment report. Section 29 is a direction to the commissioner to set up SUD technical assistance centers. Section 30 is, and the next batch of sections allocates federal funding in various ways. So Section 30 allocates federal community mental health services block grant funds for children's emerging mood disorder grants. And the following section, Section 31, does the same for first episode of psychosis grants that the Senate establishes. Moving to the next page, Senate Section 32. Allocates the federal community mental health services block grant funds for adult mental health initiative grants. Section 33 allocates money from the same funds for schooling to mental health grants. Section 34 allocates federal SUD prevention, substance abuse prevention and treatment block grants funding. And this is for the school-linked substance abuse grants that the Senate establishes in Senate Article 13. Section 35 allocates the same federal SUD prevention and treatment block grant funds for the SUD Pathfinder Companion Pilot Project. Section 36 allocates money from the same funds for the opioid epidemic response grants. Section 37, again, allocates money from the same federal funds for recovery community organization infrastructure grants. House Section 40, which corresponds with Senate Article 13, Section 38, is they're the same, and they it's a reviser instruction to replace the excellence in mental health demonstration project head note, I believe. So that is related to the certified community mental health treatment changes that both bills include earlier in the article. Finally, House Section 41 and Senate Article 13, Section 39, these are the repealers. The Senate includes only House Paragraph B, which is the same. Paragraph A repeals mental health case management sections related to the governor's proposal. And Paragraph C is related to the children's residential treatment placement changes, and I believe the Senate includes that repealer, but in a different article. It just wasn't pulled here, so it's included elsewhere. And that concludes the walkthrough for House Article 12.
All right, thank you, Ms. Sunderman. And from this walkthrough, we get a sense of the complexity that the nonpartisan staff is dealing with in matching up these two bills. And this is kind of a bit of a digression, but as I do this, this is now my second go round co-chairing the conference committee for HHS. And each time I think there must be ways we could streamline this, make it a little easier, just to line up our bills better. So put a pin in that for next time, hoping that there will be a next time. So. Anyway, the fact that this is all so complicated and the way it gets and ends up getting woven through the articles in our bills was the reason that I asked Chair Fisher to come and talk about his piece of the bill as it relates to what we just went through and sort of give us a better overview of what he's trying to do. And Senator Benson or Senator Abler, I don't know who on your side would be sort of have the other, you know, doing this piece on the Senate side. Can you give me that, Senator Abler?
Well, absolutely. And the answer is several of us have spent a good deal of time on the substance use. Senator Upke and Senator Hoffman have done quite a bit of work, so I think you'll see interest from several of us, and so I think as different members of our side want to weigh in on something at the end, you know, as you know, you have responsibilities, and it's my ultimate responsibility, but it's been a shared interest and a lot of conversation with the providers, and particularly when we look at the governor's proposal to do some changes, we think those are going to be actually sort of harmful to the system, and so we were dug into that quite a bit. So we're trying to find a way that maybe still saves some money, but doesn't make people not get the services they need. So if that's fair, when you see hands, Madam Chair, I just acknowledge them as you see them. So thank you. And looking forward to Representative Fisher being here and happy for his attention to the topic.
Thank you, Senator Abler. And so it's our intention to have some discussion here, not just have a presentation, but have some discussion among members. And I should just note that I think it's Senator Utke who's working now with Representative Liz Olson on some of the opioid pieces. Is that, or is it Senator Curran? I've forgotten. One of you is hopefully working with the, okay. Thank you, Senator Curran. So they are working on some of the opioid pieces. And I think some of that shows up in this article too, if I'm not mistaken. So, but, anyway, I will turn it over to invite Chair Fisher. Welcome to the conference committee. And if you can somewhat relate it, we don't want you to go through what House Research just went through going section by section, but if you would just talk about what your goals are here and what you're doing in your piece of the House bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Labeling. Thank you, everyone on the conference committee, for the opportunity to be here this morning. In terms of the Behavioral Health Division out of the House, we had some very large goals, is realizing that in the behavioral health world, the biggest problems we have, we never really created the system out there. And so as a result, a lot of the challenges that we face are revolved around never having properly built the system out, and also recognizing that there have been a lot of stigmas over time with people not feeling comfortable to receive mental health services, et cetera. One of the things that from my background is I spent the last 14 years working for small nonprofits, working with youth who are at risk of being homeless or who are homeless. And I've seen a lot of youth who've had trauma, many of them are of color. And one of the big things that we're looking at is there's still a lot of stigmas in that world. 14 years ago when I was starting to do this work is that there were a lot of stigmas across the board that have slowly gone away, particularly in the majority communities, but in a number of the communities of color, there's still a lot of stigmas there. And some of the things that we've realized over time is that it's trying to change the system to meet people where they're at. And that's some of the things that we've looked at. We've seen the provisions come through on the universal mental health standards being put together. This was getting at some of those problems of trying to bring things together to meet people where they're at, start treatment, start working with people right off the bat. Some of the things that we recognized is, and I've seen this a lot in the work I've been familiar with, is that there's still a big resistance or big problem in overcoming the stigmas in communities of color. And one of the things that we realized and I've heard over time is that part of the reason the stigmas are there is because when people in those communities go to seek services, they don't see anyone that looks like them. So as a result, if they don't see anyone that looks like them and have their backgrounds, be able to relate to their lived experiences, it's very hard for them to want to seek help. And as a result, that further isolates them. And one of the big things that we talked about early on in our committee was the area, the bill from Representative Bang, our House File 970. This covers sections 2, 7, 8, and 32. And what this did was taking a very conscious look is if we want to make sure that we're breaking down the disparities in the mental health world of people getting services, we need to change the way we look at it, change the way we bring people in. And part of that is coming down to looking at how people are getting trained, getting people brought in to providing services, getting them through the colleges so that they get the background training so that we have more people looking like the communities that they're serving.
And Representative Fisher, excuse me for interrupting. I just want to flag here that Senator Benson and I had talked about having a separate kind of hearing on this, and we're still planning to do that, where we bring in the health, the boards and Representative Vang and probably NAMI. And so we'll do a deeper dive on that piece. Just want to let you know. Thanks.
Right.
Please proceed.
No, thank you for letting me know that. Then I won't spend much more time on that, except to say that, this was something that came out of our committee unanimously in a bipartisan way. As a matter of fact, all the legislation that came out of the Behavioral Health Division had unanimous support from the entire committee. And this was because of the amount of work that we were putting into it. There was a lot of bipartisan amendments that went on to a lot of these bills, including this provision here. The next big area that we spent a bit of discussion on was on the SUD reform package. And I know this here is a very large part of what will be talked about going forward. And one of the challenges that we recognized early on is the governor's proposal. When the governor's proposal came out, there were a lot of taking the federal dollars that were coming in to replace state dollars and using those state dollars to balance the general fund. You know, back at the time when the governor was making his proposal, we were facing a large deficit. And fortunately, as we were going through session, that changed substantially. And one of the things that we pushed back is that any federal dollars coming in that freed up state dollars, those state dollars should be reinvested back into the substance use world and also into providing better funding for mental health services across the board. And that's a lot of what this work did. We also spent a lot of time, I had Representative Frankie with myself. We spent a lot of time working with providers from March, getting their input on things. And so as a result, when we came together with our proposal, we were able to do a lot of work on improvements of making sure that we had a better base rate going in. I know that some concerns that people had was about elimination of some of the add-ons. And one of the reasons that we eliminated two of the add-ons is these were provisions that are required in the base work in the demonstration project. We felt very strongly, if these are requirements, instead of having add-ons and going through all that extra work for people to get the add-ons, is they should be part of the base package. And that's part of the reason that we rose up the base rate the way we did. We wanted to make sure that we were setting up a situation so that nobody was falling behind. And I know that having talked to some providers came out a little bit ahead, some are about even, and there's probably more work that we need to take a look at, but we feel strongly that as we were dealing with the issue, that the big focus is dealing with the base rates, make sure we've got a survivable base rate situation going forward. We also wanted to make sure that we had a end date set up out there so that people knew what to expect. And we wanted to set up the end date in such a way that it would be a couple of years out before providers would drop off of receiving any NMA support. And a lot of the reason that we were putting out where we did versus where the governor's was to provide us the opportunity to have several more sessions to be able to come back in, because we know we're looking at a lot of big changes here with the 1115 project, and that things are going to pop up that are going to need additional tweaking as we go forward. We realize that whatever package we finalize today is going to need continued work going on in future sessions as people realize, are things working out as people are hoping for, or are they not? And some of the issues that we had looked at as we were addressing those things is making sure that we had enough support out there for the providers to be able to come in. So we've done that several ways. Is first of all, is making sure that there's a technical assistance group from DHS is where they're going out. And I call it hand-holding for the small providers. A lot of the small providers don't have the administrative and support staff to be able to navigate the rules and getting things set up. And so we tasked DHS with providing technical experience and expertise in their staff to work with these small people that handhold them through the process, making sure that if there's any barriers, helping them walk through the barriers, helping them jump through the hoops so that everyone can be remaining in the project as we get to the different cutoff dates. Some of the cutoff dates we had is we had some soft ones after 6 months, and then after 12 months, if people were not being able to meet all the qualifications, that they would still be able to access MA rates for another year. Also, in addition to that, we were looking at creating another group where this would be regular meetings with providers, DHS, people who receive services to see how are things going. What are the issues that we see out there, not only in the short term, but the long term, to make sure that we've got continuous input being provided through this, not only during the project, but going forward in the future, so that we've always got good lines of communication to see what is workable and what is not. We also want to make sure that we are hitting on paperwork reduction. We've got provisions in for there. We understand that was very important to March. We also understood very importantly that we wanted to make sure that the recovery grants were still being done out there. And these were the things that when we were taking the state dollars that were freed up, putting them into these kind of programs so that we could make sure that the support structures that would make the SUD world more sustainable was being built out. And that's how we were using the state dollars that were freed up in the process. And I could probably go on for quite a while on some of these things. So I just wanted to kind of hit it real high. I know I've not hit everything, but kind of open up for questions and discussions that may come. I can imagine that there's some. And I know that as I've gone through it, I've got some questions too, but I just want to kind of stop at this point.
Thank you so much, Chair Fisher. That's helpful to me. I just hope that the public watching this gets a taste of how complicated this all is and how important it is to have members who are digging into these issues, because they are so important. So I really welcome any discussion from anybody on the committee here. And if I didn't prep anybody to come on the Senate side and do the similar thing, but I certainly would welcome it, and don't want to push you if you're not ready, but Senator Utke.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I won't go into it a whole lot. Representative Fisher covered a lot of the stuff that we've all been working on, but some of mine that I'm going to we'll cover here briefly will also I want to engage the department because I'm going to ask for some of their responses to this too, because of what's all involved in the 1115 Demonstration Act. You know, currently, if we look at the proposed governor's budget, which, you know, again, coming from the department, is showing a savings. But then when you look at the numbers and where these things are coming from, you know, we're seeing that basically providers are disappearing. And
so, Senator, excuse me a second. I just would say, you know, this, the governor's budget is not on the table here. What's in our two bills is on the table. And as Representative Fisher said, you know, the governor's budget was put together, you know, there was a process and that was put together originally when we were facing a deficit. So I don't know how helpful. We could certainly have the department respond, but they're going to be responding to what's in our bills, not to the governor's original proposal, because that's no longer in front of us.
Yeah, but that's what's based on what we're seeing in fiscal notes, or at least it appears to be. So it definitely is in play, and we need to talk about it because we have just come through 14 months of COVID lockdowns and restrictions and such, which we are seeing the use of drugs and alcohol and mental health, everything expanding, and in some cases almost exploding, which falls right back into the topic of the SUD treatments. And in this case, we're talking about the 1115 demonstration project. And going forward, you know, as we look at what that demonstration is supposed to be doing, which hopefully in the end is eliminating and get some of this needs of services and getting people back on their feet and helped. But I don't believe at this point we are moving forward in the right direction. I know in the Senate we've got some guardrails in our bill built in to protect our providers, because at this point the project was supposed to have been a voluntary project. It ended up being a mandatory project, and we've had to address some of those things. So that's what some of what you'll see in our language is, we need to push some of those dates out. We need to ensure that our providers are going to be with us throughout this time of change. And in the end, we are just all, you know, the whole thing is about serving those with the needs. And I guess that's my biggest thing is, you know, we're wrapping our hands around rates for the providers so that they could stay in business, and also giving them the time that they needed to be able to fully enroll and fully let this demonstration project play out, so that we've got security there. But thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Utke. We'll go to Senator Abler.
Thank you. And I appreciate the dialogue. And I, you know, and Madam Chair, I don't see any, you know, we're not even getting close to the topic of intent. It's just a matter of how we're going to make this thing work. I do have a couple questions for Representative Fisher, just if he knows the answer. Because Senator Utke mentioned that some of the provisions do parallel the governor. And I don't know where the differences are exactly, but I know one of the big differences was the deadlines. And I know that our deadline is considerably longer just because we are concerned. And so Representative Fisher, I don't know the answer to the question, but under the original proposal, 68.5% of the providers would enroll by July 1st of 2023 with the mandatory thing. And I don't know how yours matches up with that. And so do you know how many providers would be enrolled by your original deadline, and how many would be enrolled along the way up to that point?
Representative Fisher?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm going back to go through my notes. I know that on some of the original forecasts that when they were taking a look at projections, that they had different projections for the House and the Senate proposals and the governor's, and those vary a little bit. And once again, as from the discussions that I had with DHS, these are all guesstimates of what they think might happen. It could either be substantially higher or substantially lower as to what where they think that people will actually come in into the provisions. And some of this is was also a little bit of guesswork is that, and this is why we're setting up the technical advisory groups and some of these other things, is based on the assumptions of not always having these other supports out there. So we're adding the extra provisions in, make sure that we have the hand-holding occurring and directing DHS to be going out and contacting all the different providers and saying, here's what's happening, here's what's going to be occurring, here's the assistance we have, how can we help you make sure that we come in? Because we're going to have everybody, when they come in, is be able to get the enhanced rates right off the bat, even though they aren't complying with everything. So as a result, is those who are not in the project right now, they're all going to see substantial increases coming in. So while the department has projections in there that are not with everybody coming in, I would suspect that when most providers realize that they could come in and get the enhanced rates, which are much higher than what they're getting right now, that we will probably see a higher success than what is being projected there, because they can get those enhanced rates for a full year. Because we've got a couple of drop-offs is that after 12 months, if they aren't meeting all the qualifications, they can go for a hardship approach and get another 6 months of those same rates. And so these were the ways that we were trying to address it. And as a result, I think that the rates that the department are using may actually potentially be lower than what they're forecasting.
Right. Senator Abler?
Madam Chair, I appreciate, you know, the background there. But I'm only looking for kind of a specific answer, and it may not be available, but I'm not trying to badger the good representative. So I'll just tell you the number that I do know, and I mentioned it. And I'm just curious if I don't have the governor's side by side to know what the original proposal was and how you changed it to be hopefully more friendly to the providers and continue the service.
And it is considerably changed. I do know that, Senator.
And I got that. But so, I know in the Senate language, the department estimated, I think it's actually a conjecture, but even in the fiscal note, the comment, there was some subjective judgment. But so we have a 5% higher rate, and it's voluntary until July of 2025. And they estimated our uptake by July of 23 was 61% or so. The original governor's proposal was 68.5, and at some point, if not now, if you don't know, I'm curious what the estimated House uptake is. But my concern, Madam Chair, in having a deadline that stops in, and Representative Fisher, that stops in 2023, is that it seems like the high water number is 68.5 that they estimate. And it's an estimate, admittedly. But there's 31.5% of either the people or the providers, and that's not clear if it's people or providers, but 31.5% of somebody is not going to get services where they got it. And this committee is pretty well versed on the challenges that this population faces. And if suddenly their provider that they've come to trust is no longer eligible to serve them, then they're maybe just not going to go anywhere because they don't like someplace new. There may not be a place up in Senator Uckey's neck of the woods to even go to. And so that's why we were trying to drag the time out longer to assure a greater uptake. And we disagreed with the department on the fiscal note. We thought that the 5% greater rate would at least equal the governor's numbers. And so therefore our project costs more, even though I think it's gonna have similar savings. And so that's just a, you know, death by fiscal note, Madam Chair. So I wanted to just mention that. And I think those are the two big differences. And I do know that we both mentioned March, or I'm mentioning it now. Providers are providers and they have to do what we say, but at the end, there's some difficulties and challenges to even comply with this. As in every major rollout lately, the licensing and the qualification process has not gone according to schedule. They have, the implementation was well-intended, and which is why I'm concerned about the Reimagine project, because I can't imagine it's going to go, I can't imagine, Madam Chair, that it'll be as smooth as we hope. And there's a litany of different projects that have been slow to be credentialed, even that the Senate's tried to address in its budget. So, but those are the concerns we had on a policy basis. I don't see any relief coming on the fiscal note, Madam Chair, which is too bad, but that's, I think, just where the Senate's at. So thank you.
So I'll go back to Representative Fisher to respond. And then we also, I don't know if DHS has anything they want to add, but we do have folks here if there are specific questions for them.
Thank you,
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Senator Abler, for asking some of the questions, diving into, because we want to make sure that everybody's successful and come through. We don't want to lose any providers. And what we're hoping is that what we're designing will actually create new providers out there, because we know that there are not enough providers right now. And some of the things that I found out as I was talking to folks in March and from DHS is that there will be some providers that will not enroll in here because they're primarily through the commercial programs and rely very little on the state fundings that come through these programs. When you're asking before on percentages, there was one document that I received from March about discussions they had with DHS's on assumptions of what percentage they would see in enrolling. And under the House proposal, by fiscal year 2022, they had it at 38%. In fiscal year 2023, it'd be 68.5%. In fiscal year 2024, it'd be 85%. In fiscal year 2025, it'd be up to 90%. And when comparing to the same numbers in the Senate, now this is the document I received for March, the numbers that the House had for enrollment were higher in each of the years than what the Senate provision was. So even though we may have had a little bit lower, these were numbers that were showing it might be because we had quicker deadlines in there. And as a result, we had more people coming in earlier. And when I say people, more providers coming in earlier, according to the observations that that I had provided to me through the documents that I've got in front of me right here.
Senator Abler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm happy to hear from the department. And just to comment, Representative Fisher expressed it pretty well, and we find it frustrating that a 5% rate, you know how, yeah. Madam Chair, you've sat through your whole career, these groups have always wanted more money, and they always work at a very narrow margin, and it seems to me that extra 5% would be very motivating. But my concern I just want to re-express is that as of 2023, July 1st, that these providers are going to be out of the program, and they can re-enroll later, but they're going to be There's a termination point. That was just a concern. So I'll leave it at that. Thank you. I'm looking forward to hearing from the department.
Okay. And Senator Abler, I think what we probably, I don't know. Well, I see that Ms. Bailey is on camera. I don't know exactly what the question is for her though. And I doubt that the department just wants to opine on this without a specific question, because you know, as I've noted, this is our provision now that's in the bill, not theirs. So, Senator Abler, maybe you want to frame it up for them?
Well, I'll just ask a specific question, and it seems like this will be a good time for them to clarify. The 68.5% they project by 2023, is that providers or is that people that'll be able to be served? And that's my first question, Madam Chair.
All right, thank you. Ms. Bailey.
Chair Liebling, Senator Abler, for the record, Elise Bailey, Fiscal Policy Director for the Department of Human Services. The percentages you referenced are the percent of people and their spending that we anticipate we would get a federal match as of that date.
Senator Abler?
Well, thank you. And so, I appreciate that. And, you know, most of us will take offline, but because it's as fascinating as it might be, there's quite a bit of work ahead of us today. And I asked this before, and so perhaps you're able to now have a good thought about this. Representative Fisher mentioned that a lot of the groups not applying are going to be the private, you know, commercial companies that don't do much MA anyway. But now if it's 31.5% of the people that are going to be uncovered, where do you think they're going to get their services, particularly in greater Minnesota, if the nearby providers aren't enrolled after 23?
Ms. Bailey?
Senator Abler, by that date, the majority of percentage of spending that's added to getting FFP currently under today's system they are not MA, they're not enrolled in MA. And so we are anticipating with this change that actually under today's system, people could be on MA and they're not receiving MA for one reason or another, that under the new system, we would have more people becoming eligible for MA and therefore drawing down a federal match for these services.
Madam Chair.
Senator Abler.
This reminds me of the wages and rates discussion that we had. So, but there's 31% of the people that aren't going to have a provider to go to. Isn't that right? And so what's going to happen to them? I mean, never mind new people, but if 31% of the people that could get this service that ostensibly want it, that you came up with 68.5%, I mean, what are they supposed to do?
All right, I'll go, well, you
that's
know
my,
what?
And then I'll leave it at that, Madam Chair. So.
Okay, Senator Abler, I'm gonna go to Representative Schultz, who has her hand up. I don't know if she was, I suspect she has something to add to this conversation or.
Thank you.
Go ahead, Representative Schultz.
It wasn't specific to Senator Abler's question, but it was related to his comment about these groups always asking for more money. And I'm just wondering if the agency could give us information on where Minnesota compares to other states in terms of reimbursement for these services and coverage.
Ms. Bailey, is that something you can address?
Chair Liebling, I don't have that at the tip of my fingers, but we can certainly get that for the committee.
Okay, all right. So, well, so we have other things to cover today, and obviously this is one of the, I'll go to Senator Key in a second, but I was just gonna say, I think Senator Abler's comment is right on that we have a lot more work to do on this, and some of it will have to happen offline. And I know that Chair Fisher is absolutely ready to engage on this and work something out, because it does occur to me that, I mean, we all have the same goals here. We want to make sure that people get the treatment they need in the way that helps them best and that providers are there for them and that they're distributed. We don't, around the state, we don't want to, you know, notwithstanding that we're going to have more telehealth availability, we also want there to be actual providers in places where people can access them in person. So, I'll go to Senator Rutke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just one brief follow-up to Senator Abler's question. We can get the answer offline if need be, but his question about where are the 31.5% going to get their services, I would like to dig into that. And if it comes from the department later as we work on this, great. But it is a question we need to have an answer for, or at least try to get one, because that's important, particularly out in areas where providers are real scarce. And if we're going to make it even harder, we don't want to do that. So thank you.
All right. Thank you, Senator Utke. And Chair Fisher, did you want to have a final word here? I don't know. We will have a lot more discussion offline on this, I think, with a few people. And I don't know if it's not entirely clear to me who Chair Fisher would be talking with here primarily, but Chair Fisher, I'm sure you can work that out after this discussion. But did you want to have a final word here before we move on to other sections?
I want to say thank you to everyone very much for the continued discussion. This is something that I know that we're going to need to continue to look at. And I think that one of the areas that we can talk a lot more on once we've got targets out there is taking a look at the base rate. I think that's where we need to do work on addressing increases for providers to make sure we don't lose any is the area that we really want to be able to focus on. But I think this is going to be a lot of good hard work going forward, and I look forward to continuing these. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much for joining us today, Chair Fisher, and thanks everybody for the discussion on that and for everybody's hard work on it, because it's obviously not an easy thing to figure out. Okay, we are now going to go to, I think that also I didn't go to Chair Schultz to talk about anything else in this section, and I know she has other pieces of this. Chair Schultz, did you want to address any of the rest of this? We talked about the VANG portions of this that we're going to put off to the side for now, but was there anything else in here that you felt like we needed to cover before we move on?
Sure, I'll just mention a few things. many of the governor's provisions are here to regarding the Family First initiatives to do more person and family-centered coordination for child services. There's a provision in here that's house only that tries to focus, this is a governor's provision on case management services that tries to have more consistency with negotiated rates, MA rates for targeted case management. So instead of counties negotiating directly with vendors, the state has a statewide rate methodology. The sober housing program recommendations, this is Representative Edelson's bill, and the Senate has similar language. Very important to look at the sober housing program recommendations and evaluations and generates a report. The tribal language for when there are overpayments, setting up protocols if there are future overpayments and how the commissioner is going to provide information to the tribes about those overpayments and how to resolve those. I do have some questions for Senator Abler about using the Consolidated Appropriations Act revenue and whether that's appropriate for some of the provisions that the Senate funds in this article.
Okay, thanks, Chair Schultz. And Senator Abler, I'm going to go to you, and I'm noting there are a lot of Senate-only positions in here, too, so if you want to go ahead and...
And I'll highlight them just on an overview level. I'll respond to Representative Schultz's first question. And if there's a singular point on the list of topics that we have out of those couple of block grants, it's that this committee should spend the money on those before we go home. The way that the ability we have to balance the needs of the state, 201 of us scattered around listening to everybody, I think is very productive, and a good working relationship with the department, I think makes it just eminently valuable that we do this, particularly, I think, as we're going to see our target lean up considerably for any number of reasons, that this will be a way to sweeten some of these very, very important things. And we're not particularly attached to any one of the proposals that we have. We wanted to provide a buffet of options that we thought were pretty cool. But if you see, there are some ones that are just very, very tempting. You know, some of the mental health things, first episode of psychosis, emerging mood disorders, adult mental health initiative grants, school-linked mental health grants, school-linked substance use grants, opioid response grants, and on. There, none of those are something that people wouldn't like. And so it's a matter of how we can truly address some of these needs that are there. So I'll just leave it at that, Madam Chair.
Yeah, and Senator Abler, could I ask just a brief question about that? Yeah. So I note that you have sort of these different buckets of school-linked grants, and I'm just wondering why you're separating them, or how, could just explain briefly, like, you know, we have the school-linked mental health, and I think everybody agrees that's really successful. And school-linked SUD, is it just different providers, or, you know, why do it separately?
That might have been Senator Utke's piece. I don't remember who worked on that, but it seemed to make sense to us, particularly with COVID and what's all been going on with some of the students and the challenges. So I don't know if he wants to raise his hand if it's him. Otherwise, I can try to get something more, but I don't have more than that, personally.
Okay. Just something that occurred to me. Thank you.
Yeah. And there's a few more topics, Madam Chair, if I can.
Oh, please go ahead. And Senator Utke has his hand up. I don't know if he wants to respond on that.
Let's do that, Madam Chair, please.
Okay. Senator Utke.
All I was going to say is I will check on that real quick and get back to you, because I don't have that at my fingertips.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Senator Abler.
So I'll just kind of go through the biggest items. Representative Schultz mentioned the targeted case management services stream, systemization of it. If you read the governor's proposal, it says this is the down payment on a lot more work to come. And that just strikes terror into me, thinking that we're going to go meddle with this area that seems to actually be working. The efforts at simplifying or changing rates, like in the family foster care, which is, in my view, going to crush some of the providers who have been doing this and actually shut down services in the name of good policy. And you can argue that it's good policy, but if you move into an arena that's been maybe clunky but working, and then you try to fix it, it sometimes can ruin everything. And so that's the concern the Senate had about that. On the compulsive gambling, did you guys take the $1 million in savings that the governor took? All right, and thank you for that. But there is an issue, and I don't know why we had to pay for it, but and I thank you for not taking that, because that was just, I think, just ill-advised. But what's going on in that North Star gambling thing is they have a really hard time knowing the money that they're supposed to get, and they're just getting it timely. It's money that comes out of, it's a pot of money. Nobody gets to keep it. And so if they could just know what it was in a more regular way, that's what the Senate was trying to do with that. So, and then one other, the sober housing, we really need to get some standards in place there. And I noticed the deadlines are different. And so the question is going to be, when do you want to fix it? And I wouldn't actually mind trying to fix it next session. And so maybe both deadlines are wrong. Maybe it should be February 1st. So we actually can try to put together some standards. And I would like their group to come up with their own standards of what they consider to be a workable one, and then run off the ones that are really causing the problems and make them stop hurting people. And then finally, I don't know if Senator Hoffman is available to talk, but we did some work on some substance use pilot programming with Anoka County. And it was also my thinking that maybe St. Louis County would like to pile on. And so we thought to add that in, but we didn't have any communications with that. But I thought those would be two representative counties just that we all both could kind of keep an eye on, or Representative Schultz and I, but I thought they would be kind of iconic counties. And so when people leave St. Cloud, the Veterans Program, or they leave some SUD program, nobody knows where they go. And so particularly the ones that are MA clients on Rule 25, if we could track those, that's part of the pilot. And the other is working with David Wellstone with some apps that they have that actually could markedly increase the success. SUD success rates are in the 30% range. With some of this monitoring and Pathfinder program, it could be as good as 60 or 70 for very small money. And so we are going to try to work on that. So I don't know if Senator Hoffman's around, but if not, that's that. And so that's all I have to talk about, Madam Chair.
Okay, well, Representative Schultz has her hand up, and then we'll go to Senator Hoffman. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And if I heard Senator Abler correctly, it sounds like we probably can get to agreement on the sober housing program recommendations. So the House has a report due by March 1st, 2022. The Senate's report is due by September 1st. So it sounds like Senator Abler's leaning towards the earlier date. So I just want to see if we can get that on record. As I think everything else is the same for that.
Yeah, maybe in February.
Section 25.
Oh, sorry. Madam Chair, forget we're in a meeting here. Sorry.
Yeah, it's all right. Senator Abler.
So, yeah, but maybe even earlier if you want to try to get something done. March is actually almost kind of late. You're almost at the policy deadline. So we'll sort that out. So I'm happy that we had a really good couple hearing or two about it. And it was it was compelling. So thank you.
Yeah, and it does sound to me, too, like there's a lot of agreement here, at least on goals, and we got a little work to do to sort some things out. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I agree with your observation. There's lots of agreement. I mean, we know that substance abuse disorder is really fragmented throughout not only Minnesota, but in the county or country. And when you look at the demonstration projects like Senator Abler talked about, we heard from experts that we're up in the 60 to almost 80% success rate based on a couple of factors. I mean, when you're in recovery, you got to have your circle of friends or your circle of supports or mentors that are around you. And what we know works well. And so what Senator Abler was trying to do and is trying to do was to create that area to show that it can be done and that we can actually increase, because right now the Minnesota model everybody talks about, it's only at about a 30-32% success rate. And so long term, that's not good for recovery. And what we need to do is make sure that we're doing what's not only efficient but saves us as a state lots of money in the end, because it isn't somebody that's recycling through the system. And so you see a lot of support in that, Madam Chair. And so I just wanted to add to that, Senator Abler is right, the numbers are there. And so it would be worth our investment as a state, and as well as, because we know that the outcomes are going to be positive.
Okay, thank you, Senator. Anything else in this article that we need to talk about right now? We could move on, I think. Okay, well, good discussion on all of these really important topics. And I, you know, look forward to having us get to some resolution. And it looks like, you know, we can make some real improvements, I think, for the people we're serving. So, great. Okay, so next is, we're going to move on to House Article 13, which is the direct care and treatment article. And Ms. Sunderman, this one should be pretty quick. And this is Senate Article 13, labeled behavioral health. But so Ms. Sunderman.
Madam Chair and members, this, as you said, would be much shorter. This is one section. This is House Article 13, which is behavioral or direct care and treatment. It corresponds to one section in Senate Article 13. It's Senate Article 13, Section 5. These are exactly the same, and they are the governor's proposal specifying that the county payment share for behavioral health hospital services applies to services for child and adolescent behavioral health hospitals.
And all right.
That concludes the article.
See, short and sweet. And the only thing I would say about this is right now is that this does have a cost impact. Otherwise, you know, so we can't really adopt it just yet. Senator Abler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, you know, we did not work on this at all in the Senate. We just took it as kind of easy money, then I presume the House did something and the governor thought it made sense. We did not do much background on this, but I wanted to comment. You and I have been through times when there's been a county share that pops up and we get $4 million. And as the Anoka Treatment Center, I think it's become like $18 million or something. So if there can be an amendment to limit the county exposure to the amount that we're saying we're taking, so in the event that it grows to $4 million, they don't have to bear a $4 million cost. And I don't know how you would do that, but I think that would be friendly to the counties if we're going to do this as a share. The second problem, just on the policy basis, is some counties have nowhere to put these folks. And, you know, if I had more time to work on this, I think I would have tried to offset the money. If they would put money into their own service networks of creating housing, et cetera, then they could be off the hook. But for sure, I think if we could limit the cost, I don't know how you do that, but that's just my thought, Madam Chair. Thank you.
So, Senator Abler, I guess what I would say about this provision, and you know, other members might, this would be probably more in Chair Schultz's bailiwick here, but what I would say about this is that, you know, we are pretty attentive to not shifting costs to counties, I have to say, and I think that's across probably all members. This has happened a lot in the past. It's been kind of an, you know, it's not on our fiscal note, so therefore it doesn't exist and counties end up with a lot of costs. But in this particular provision, we have had some discussion about it. I mean, I think that this is one where there's policy behind it. It's not just, oh, we need a few million dollars, let's get it from the counties. And surely we can have more discussion about it, but this HHS process right now, I think, is pretty good for counties. I haven't, there's a lot of good stuff for counties in these, in all across our bills, both our bills, I would say. And I think this is not a year in which there's going to be a big dump of expense on counties. On the contrary, in our bill, we actually, you know, give some explicit relief to counties, which interestingly, I'm not hearing a lot from them about how much they like it. I did hear a lot from them about how much they didn't like the cost that they were bearing, but our bill pays them back that $8 million or so that, you know, they were being charged on that IMD issue. And so, you know, I think that this is, we're kind of, I would say, this is a pretty good balance. This is a pretty small provision, but appreciate your point. Chair Schultz, did you want to say anything? Because I'm kind of just going off my memory here. I don't know if you had anything to add.
So yeah, so this is a provision that adds children, and that the state will not pay for children who no longer need to be placed at the community behavioral health hospital. And the county would have to assume if they can't triage that patient somewhere else that, you know, requires fewer services, that they're responsible for that cost. And so that's what this legislation does that came from the governor. And, you know, counties do have some concern because they may not be able to find a place. So we'll continue to work with the county. Senator Abler and I will work on it, but we do right now have identical language, and it is a savings in our bill.
Okay, thank you, Chair Schultz. So, okay, so I think unless there's, you know, so there's a little more work to do possibly on this, even though we have identical language, I think we can probably move on from this one. And I think, let's see, the next one that we are planning to do is House Article 16, Senate Article 19, which is the miscellaneous article or articles. And Ms. Mock is going to walk us through that. I need just a second here to find it. And in this one, it's a lot more in there. So even though it's not, it's about a 3-page document that we're going to be working off of. And Ms. Vang, I don't know if you can screen share that one, but it might be helpful. Great, thank you. And Ms. Mock.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, I'm Annie Mock with House Research, and I'm going to walk through the section comparison of House Article 16 and Senate Article 19. So House Section 1 creates the Office of Ombudsperson for American Indian Families, and this is a House-only provision, and I'll come back to it in just a minute. Senate Sections 1 and 4 are Senate-only provisions that prohibit the discrimination for purposes of coverage or eligibility for an organ transplant, anatomical gifts or related treatment and services due to an individual's disability. And I'll note for members that the House Judiciary Public Safety Bill includes identical language. House Sections 2 and 9 through 15 are House-only provisions that establish an American Indian community-specific board. And this board is established to appoint and assist the Ombudsperson for American Indian Families, which that office was established in House Section 1. These sections also modify the existing Office of Ombudsperson for Families to account for the establishment of the Office of Ombudsperson for American Indian Families. The Senate bill does not include these provisions, but it does direct the Commissioner of Human Services to evaluate options for reorganizing the Office of the Ombudsperson for Families. And that's in Article 11, so I think we'll be walking through that later today. House Section 3 and Senate Section 2 establish in statute the Retain Grant Program, which provides competitive grants to childcare professionals to incentivize them to remain in the workforce. The language in the bills is similar, except that the Senate bill does not require grant applicants to have a current membership with the Minnesota Quality Improvement Registry tool. House Sections 4 and 5 are House-only provisions that make modifications to the Teach Grant Program, which is a program that provides scholarships and education incentives to individuals who are in the early care and education workforce. House Sections 6 and 7 are House-only provisions, and they allow the Commissioners of Health and Human Services to use a reverse auction process for competitive bidding. House Section 8 is a House-only change that makes clarifying and policy changes to the Cultural and Ethnic Communities Leadership Council. House Section 16 and Senate Section 8, these are similar proposals to establish a competitive grant program to expand access to childcare for children with disabilities. The House proposal includes some additional details, which are noted in the bill summary comparison, but overall the provisions are similar in both bills. House Section 17 is a House-only provision that directs DHS to establish a grant program to test strategies that family child care providers can use to share services services among them. House Section 18 is also a House-only provision, and this directs the governor's children's cabinet to evaluate how the state uses federal coronavirus relief money to meet the state's needs in the area of early care and education. House Section 19 and Senate Section 10 have similar proposals to direct DHS to issue a report on foster children's participation in early care and education programs. Most of the differences between the bills, the two provisions in the bills, are technical. And now we'll start with a series of Senate-only provisions, and many of these Senate-only provisions allocate federal money that the state will receive for childcare under the American Rescue Plan Act. And I'll note for members that the House also allocates this federal childcare money, but it does so in the House's appropriation article. So you'll hear about that at a later time. So Senate Section 5 creates a grant program for childcare providers to help them reopen closed childcare facilities or maintain or improve an operating facility. Senate Section 6 provides for public health support funds for childcare programs to help them with costs sort of for complying with COVID-related guidance. Senate Section 7 directs DHS to contract with a third party to do an evaluation of the state's quality rating and improvement system for childcare programs. The system is known as Parent Aware. So there isn't a similar House provision before this committee, but the House's education bill contains a provision that also requires an evaluation of Parent Aware. And the language is a little bit different from the Senate provision, but is conceptually similar. And just to be further confusing, while that House evaluation, the House's evaluation of Parent Aware is in the education bill, it's actually paid for in the House's HHS bill. So you're gonna hear about that when we go through the House's appropriation article. Senate Section 9 directs the Commissioner of DHS to establish a working group to develop a plan to maximize the affordability, quality, and staff qualifications and diversity of childcare and early education programs. The House bill does not include a similar provision, but the House Education Bill does. So the House Education Bill establishes a task force to develop strategies similar to meet the goal for all families in the state to have access to affordable, high-quality early care and education programs. Senate Section 11 allocates up to $500,000 from the federal child care money for the working group I just talked about. And then the House Education Bill appropriates the same amount for its task force. Senate Section 12 allocates $750,000 in each of fiscal years 2022 and 2023 from the federal child care money for grants to nonprofits to provide job skills training, career counseling, and job placement assistance to help economically challenged individuals begin a career in childcare. Senate Section 13 allocates $4.5 million in each of fiscal years 2022 and 2023, again, from federal childcare money for the Jerry Ralph Family Supports and Improvement Plan. And this would issue grants to counties to coordinate a voluntary information sharing program for county agencies, child care providers, and families to better understand the needs of families to receive child care assistance. Senate Section 14 allocates $375,000 in each of fiscal years 2022 and 2023 from the federal child care money to the Retain Grant Program, which I mentioned earlier was established in statute in both the House and the Senate bills. Senate Section 15 allocates $10 million in each of fiscal years 2022 and 2023 from the federal child care money to gives this money to communities to increase the supply of child care providers. At least 60% of the grants must be awarded to communities outside the metro area, and the grants have to be used to implement projects to reduce the child care shortage in the state. Senate Section 16 allocates $3 million in fiscal year 2022 from the federal child care money for a competitive grant to a nonprofit organization to operate a business training program for childcare providers. Senate Section 17 allocates $252 million in fiscal year 2022 from the federal childcare money for the public health support funds for childcare providers. And that was the program that was established under Senate Section 6. And then Senate Section 18 allocates $50 million in fiscal year 2022 from the federal child care money for the child care facility revitalization grant program that was established under Senate Section 5. Senate Section 19, we're moving away from allocating federal money here. Senate Section 19 directs the Commissioner of Human Services to issue a request for information to identify available technology to support foster family recruitment and training through an online portal. And then finally, House Section 20 is a House-only provision that directs the revisor to renumber the TEACH grant program. And that concludes the walkthrough.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Ms. Mock. Appreciate that. So there are a number of provisions in here that we could probably spend a little bit of time talking about. First of all, I should note that the provision that Ms. Mock discussed in that's in kind of on the second line of the sheet that we just went through about discrimination of coverage or eligibility for an organ transplant for people with disabilities. As I noted before, I do sit on the Judiciary Committee. That provision was heard there. It's in their bill. And we did receive some outreach from that committee. And, you know, I my kind of feeling about this is that it would be just as well to let some other committees handle some provisions if we can, because we've got plenty of work to do here. I don't know how other members feel about that. I certainly think it has broad support. But, you know, my preference would be to kind of let them deal with that over there. Senator Abler?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And I kind of think it might be just as well to keep it in this committee. That committee has a few topics to handle, and at least the chair on our side is somewhat policy averse. So just a thought. So you do what you want.
Well, that is, yeah, I do see your point, Senator Abler. You know, actually, there is no real downside to having things travel in more than one place. It's the last thing enacted is the thing that governs if there are differences. But, you know, so anyway, we're not at the point of adopting it right now anyway, but I certainly would go with members' preferences on it. You know, you're right, some things, yeah, it may have more likelihood of happening here, but it does have broad support. I haven't heard a word from anybody that they don't support this provision. So, you know, if there is Senator Benson.
I could, Madam Chair, I would just assume we handle it here. And if the language is similar here and in the House, perhaps staff could get a comparison for our purposes. I feel like that committee is not going to be as productive as we are. And so if we could instruct staff to do a comparison or a cursory review to see if there are any significant differences, I'd like to just handle it here.
All right, Senator, that's fine with me. And hey, maybe we can be in a competition with the other conference committees. We will be the most productive. Even though we had the last bill out the door, but you know, we could still be the most productive conference committee. All right, I think that's it. That's a good goal for us. I think we could probably do it.
Okay.
All right. Other provisions in this article. There is this kind of, please, Representative Pinto.
Well, and Madam Chair, I had some questions and comments about a couple of the child care related provisions, but there may be another topic that you were going to get to, and I'm happy to wait for that. There's no, in whatever order you'd like.
Well, I'm really fine with whatever you want to do, Representative Pinto. Go ahead and jump in. I was just going to follow the order in the sheet, but that's just, you know, just for no special reason than following the order in the sheet. So go ahead and you jump in and talk about the things that are on your mind.
Well, thank you. I mean, I was going to actually move to, I guess it would have been the fourth line in the sheet. And so if there was something on that, like on that first line, I'm not sure if there was some arbitrary or otherwise that you'd rather to kind of do it that way. I was just going to go through kind of line by line through a few things. But should I proceed with that, or do you want to do the first line? It looks like I should.
Yeah, the other topic is the one about the Ombudsman for Families. And I know Representative Schultz can talk about that, but I don't think there's any real order preference. So please go ahead.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. So I wanted to ask first about the retained grants program and the comment, which I will admit I had not noticed, or I just want to see the Senate removing the quality and improvement registry tool, and just if I don't know if it's staff or otherwise. So just for members who aren't familiar with this, our quality
quality metric in our state is parent aware, and you'll see that we have evaluations of parent aware separately in this article for the Senate and then in the education bill for the House, another example of a provision that's crossing multiple committees. I just wasn't sure if either staff or perhaps a senator is able to just explain about the removal of that requirement and the retain grant program.
I think Senator Abler wants to do that. Senator. Sure.
Well, I'm happy to, and a lot of this can go offline, but just on the global scale, I think the, while parent aware has kind of taken hold, I think the enthusiasm for seeing that as like the gold standard is probably it's a bell curve of enthusiasm. Maybe it's bimodal. I don't know. Both ends, and I'm not sure what the middle ground is, but. So our answer to the concerns that they're actually in the Senate bill is also a study of parent aware. And I think it sounds like the Senate has such a thing as well to see, does it really matter? Has it really made the difference you thought? And that would be, I think, a very interesting report. And so what the Senate did is we actually added more money and broadened out who can get it. And so we're, if you see a theme in the Senate bill, it's, we really want it to be, care to be available. And We're taking the thought of the childcare desert quite seriously, and not that the Senate, not that the House is not doing that, but that's a key focus. And when we get to the other provisions, you'll see some of that.
Chair Pinto?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative, or thank you, Senator Abler. And actually, that's right. I guess my question was phrased as a technical question, but I really was looking for that broader response that you gave, because it felt to me like it was a bit of a sense, as you say, I've noticed as well, but that parent aware, it has felt like it's been under some fire from a variety of directions. And so I guess, as you say, we have the evaluation on the House side as well. And so I think, I guess when we get to that, I'll be eager to talk more, because I agree with you. We want to make sure that we have a quality metric and system that people can have real broad faith in and trust in. And so anyway, that's helpful to understand that. So thank you. And then, Madam Chair, my next item was just a note. This is on the second page of the list of sections, the foster care enrollment. And this is section 19 of the House article and section 10 of the Senate article. Just a note for conference committee members that I believe that Senator Coleman and Representative Patiza Watoon, who are the authors of this provision, are in some discussion about a possible amendment to the language. There was some confusion about the cost to this provision. And so I think that they're gonna be coming to us with some language just to highlight, I guess, maybe partly for Chair Benson and Senator Abler and for others on the conference committee as well, that may be something that's, I kind of think that may works just to give you just a heads up about that, just to say. And then I had a question then about section 6 of Article 19 of the Senate bill, the public health support funds. It says Senate only, and Ms. Mock's review talked about it that way, but the House has, I think, a very similar provision as well. And so one question I had was just where the House provision is as compared to the Senate provision. So to remind members, there's about $325 million in stabilization funds, they're called, which we've received from the feds, and they're required to be spent to stabilize the childcare sector, regular rolling grants. And so maybe just one question first from Ms. Mock is if she can remind me and others where that is in the as well on the House side, and maybe about how comparable those two proposals are.
And Representative Pinto, are you talking about Senate section 16 or 17 or both?
Section six.
Okay.
So right, it's COVID-19 public health support funds for child care programs was the phrasing.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, Ms. Mock.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the language for stabilization funds for child care providers in the House bill is in the appropriation article in Article 21. I can't remember the section off the top of my head. But that's where that language is. Actually, the ideas are similar, providing funds to childcare providers to find a way to help them as they're dealing with issues related to dealing with the coronavirus. There is considerably more language regarding the parameters of the program in the Senate bill with this section.
Okay.
Representative Pinto?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks, Ms. Mock. So I guess maybe this is just an highlight for conferees that although it says on the sheet, Senate only, that there is the House provision that's in the allocation article. A concern that I have, members will see at the bottom of this page in the list of sections that there's stabilization fund allocations to a number of other, to a number of uses. The Senate does to child care provider startup grants, child care business training program, and others. One concern I have is that the federal, there's a federal requirement that only 10% of those, that 90% of the funds go to these rolling grants and only 10% go to other things. And I've heard this concern from the agency. I don't know if perhaps it'd be Senator Abler. I just have a, could respond to this. I have a concern that these other allocations from the stabilization funds adds up to more than 10% of the $325 million we've received. So it'd be ineligible under federal, the federal requirements. So just if there's any thoughts or comments regarding that.
Senator Abler?
Well, thanks. And as we wrote this, the advice was, you know, rolling out. And so we decided to at least make our point clear. And again, as I mentioned before, on all these grants, if I'm the Senate or just I personally am not wedded to any one particular thing we wanted to accomplish goals. And if I have a singular goal about this, I'd like to have something to show for it when the dust settles. It is not very often you get $500 million raining down on somebody. And, you know, if we simply support monthly payments at the end, now you've, you know, eaten a lot of fish, but no one is better at fishing, as it were. Now, that's not meant to be disrespectful. And so it would be nice if, and so what the Senate does spend about $70 million on grants going out to help infrastructure. $20 million in terms of larger grants, up to $500,000, I think, under the existing program that's at the DHS for the purposes of probably, frankly, avoiding a hearing. And so if that was the desire of the conference committee, we might just, you know, fund more of the DEED program because that's all set up with the programs there. But we brought in pretty much the entire program in language just to make it clear what we were doing. And the second part is smaller grants that go out to places that are currently open, and then twice as much is going out to places you're trying to reopen. So if there was a licensed home that closed and even a new buyer would buy it and they wanted to open it up as a child care center, that would be a reopening of one. If there was a center in town that closed and then a new renter wanted to reopen it, then that would attempt to get them some modest funds. I think it's in the range of, I don't remember, I was trying to find the numbers and I couldn't find it in time, but like 50,000 or something like that, or 100, maybe it's, if it's 100, then it's 50 for a current center. But there's plenty of commentary about needing to get, you know, the bathroom upgraded, sheetrock the basement ceiling, you know, make the yard safer for the kids. And then you actually have something that might actually work under the existing payments that are out there. So at least, you know, maybe the heat costs will be lower or something like that. Because it would be, in my view, tragic that we spend all this money and at the end we still have no more places open, especially in greater Minnesota. And even in the metro, you just want to make sure you protect them all. In the Senate, we did all greater Minnesota. We just focused that, if nothing else, to make a point that we think that's where the issue is. And if I had that kind of money, I would throw it out there and just try to keep greater Minnesota open so they don't all, frankly, move to the metro and clunk up. You know, they want to stay there. So let's try to keep greater Minnesota open. So that's the point of that. So there's a couple of points is I really think this committee should spend that money. And perhaps by the time we ever get to global targets, there'll be plenty of advice about how to spend that. But I think rather than letting some outside entities do that, I notice the House that uses the cabinet, which is fine, but I see them as somewhat removed from the pedestrian world that I'm in. So thank you.
Thank you.
All right. And, I just would comment in the interim here before I go back to Representative Pinto. I would so love us to stay away from the geographic wars. Minnesotans are Minnesotans wherever they live. And I think we all agreed that we need services all across the state. And I don't know. Anyway, that's just my random comment.
Madam Chair.
Representative Pinto. Oh, Representative sure. Abler.
And I mean, I'm a suburban guy. So I was given the money all to someplace that I thought, just where I thought the greatest need was. There was nothing about, you know, so if the Metro can, I'll leave it at that. Thanks. We'll stop over.
Okay. Okay. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I want to assure everyone that we've invested a lot in the House in childcare supply and facilities improvements grants and a variety of things, and actually we're very clear that the money had to be balanced certainly to Greater Minnesota and also to the Metro because there's a need in every single one of our districts. So I suppose point received and point made there too. I guess I just want to make sure we're clear though that the stabilization fund, the funding can only go up to 10% can go to payments other than these rolling payments. So we will need to, and understood from what Senator Abler said, that to a certain extent it was sort of, we're trying a number of ideas, to a certain extent still waiting for guidance from the feds, which I actually think is a good point. That's one part of the reason that we in our bill have been real careful to not be spending federal dollars in a number of areas because we're waiting for that guidance. I appreciate that. But just want to make sure we're really clear that we can only spend up to, I suppose, $32.5 million. And right now we're more in the range of 80. I'm going to pause there, though, because I see Senator Abler has his hand up and may have something he wants to say in response to any of that.
All right. Senator Abler.
Well, thanks. And I appreciate that. And I appreciate the guidance and all of that. And I'm fully aware of one other item, Madam Chair, that come midnight on May 17th, the legislature has no hold on that money. But I think it would be prudent for the governor in trying to bring a deal together to really include us. I think that'll make it much easier. I think it's going to be better, frankly, not that who wants power. But I think engaging us shows that we can actually be one Minnesota and work together and get some things done. I wanted to comment about the public health grants. Is that the term? And so whatever money goes into that, the Senate makes a specific effort to taper them off compared to simply having it be straight and then a total cliff. COVID is going to go away. We are going to get back to normal. And for my advice is to kind of have a little larger grant and then a smaller and then taper them over. I think we did it over 2.5 years or whatever the time frame was. But I thought that way then, when the money, the providers will see, oh, the money's starting to run out, I better do something. Otherwise, I'm afraid, Madam Chair, you're going to be sitting, whoever is sitting here a couple of years from now, we're going to be talking about cuts in childcare, and it was one-time money. So thanks, that's that point. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Senator Abler.
Madam Chair,
Representative Pinto.
Thank you. I just had one more topic to ask about, and then maybe I'll have a quick comment and then be done with this for this article, if that's okay, to do this one final topic to ask about. And that one is Section 13 of the Senate bill, which is the Jerry Ralph Family Supports and Improvement Plan. And I worked very, very closely with Senator Ralph. I think members may be aware, we hosted a quarterly prenatal to three policy forum for about 4 years together. Traveled to some legislative conferences together, but if I don't know if Senator Abler is the right person, but could just explain a little more about what the intent is there. It's, as I see it, it's $9 million going to this sort of voluntary program to look at barriers for families using CCAP. And what concerns me is the biggest barrier for families using CCAP is that the payment rates are so extremely low, but maybe I'm missing something. So if you could just talk about what the goal is there, because that's $9 million for something that. Anyway, so I just would love to understand that better.
Senator Abler, can you speak to that?
Yeah, thanks, Madam Chair. I don't know that I wrote this particular one, and I don't know who the author was, and I don't know why it's that much money. But no. but we knew that Jerry worked on this a lot, and it was just kind of sad to lose him so untimely. And so this might have been Senator Hoffman worked on this. I don't remember. Does he want to fess up?
No, he won't own it either. Oh. So, well,
we can find out. So
somebody can.
Well, that would be fine. And you know, I think on our side, I mean, I don't know. I think our legislature goes a little hot and cold on naming stuff for people, right? But you know, I certainly think we all had warm feelings about Senator Ralph. So certainly no big objection there, but I think it would be great to find out more about this. Okay.
So just the final, and I'll note, thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm not positive that will be an eligible use of the Child Care Development Block Grant funds. It may depend a little bit on the details there, but maybe that's something whomever contacts me about that, we can have that conversation perhaps separately. And then I guess just a final comment that relates to a number of these, and this is perhaps a little bit in response to some of the points that were made earlier, just to remind members, this sector, early learning and care, was in deep crisis well before the pandemic. So getting back to pre-pandemic levels means that we are still in a disaster. And I really need to put it that way, like so much of what we're spending in the rest of this bill is because of how much we screwed things up when kids were 0 to 3 and 4, which is when we know the biggest difference is made. And so I just really wanna remind us that the people who do this work are in deep poverty themselves. A quarter of them are worried about even being able to afford food. And so just kind of that's something where, and this will be an ongoing conversation, I know, but just to remind us that it's not really about getting past the pandemic and get to where we were, because then we're just in a really lousy place. And in particular, the cost to provide high quality early learning care for low income kids, where it makes the biggest difference. And the science says it's like, 15 to 1 return on investment is about $1 billion. So this gets us, about halfway there with the $500 million that's been mentioned. There's significant other discretionary funds. And so I just kind of want to make sure that we're very clear that that not making that investment is just something that we all end up paying for many times over. And so we just have to figure out a way to do that. And so let's kind of keep that in mind. I'd encourage members as we do this. I'm really excited to see the high quality, affordable child care and early education working group in the Senate bill. There's a similar provision in the House Education bill. So really a commitment by both chambers to say we really need to get this right, and I'm eager to do that. So all done with this line of questions. Thanks so much, Madam Chair.
Yeah, and thanks for your work on that, Chair Pinto. I think there's broad agreement that this is how important this area is, and not only because of the impact on the children and their futures, but also just as a workforce matter, right? We know that parents cannot be working productively when their children don't have care. And as a future matter, just looking at our population dynamics, we just really need that. And I think employers are asking for it too. So it just has ramifications through just so many things that we do. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Pinto, incoming. I'm really, thank you for bringing up the valid point about the investment in early childhood. And we know, and you're right, Steve Barnhart from Rutgers did that original study that was done out of North Carolina. And Senator Abler's smiling because he knows where I'm going with this conversation. And back in 1986, the Fed said we got to do a comprehensive, coordinated, and collaborative look at early childhood, right? And so we know our state system, a lot of other state systems too, are really fragmented on their approach. And what you and Jerry were doing, or Senator Ralph were doing, was absolutely, I think, needs to be ongoing and kept up. And so I really want to say thank you for bringing that piece up, because we need to do a deep dive at our early intervention services system and our early childhood system to make sure that there's braiding, branding, there's integrated services, and that's also looked at across the board. And if you want to take a look at Public Law 99457, Dave Pinto, then that'll tell you exactly where that language is coming from. And I'm not going to quote it because Abler's going to say something. So thank you very much for bringing that up. Good job.
All right, Senator Abler, and then let's go on to other topics because we're kind of running a little bit behind here. Senator Abler.
No, Madam Chair, this is other topics. So I'm just looking at two more items in this section that I just wanted to mention. the ombudsperson was very interesting to me, and I think it is time to kind of restructure that group. The Senate asked for a study from the commissioner, and frankly, we were going to fix it, so it just said the group should figure it out. And it became kind of a dialogue in the Senate, and we decided we were leaving that alone for now. But there is some controversy behind this, and I think it's a function of, frankly, why they need to be distinct. And so I favor that approach. I saw you added some money. Can you tell me how much money you guys added to it? I couldn't find that list.
Yeah, so Senator Abler, I was going to go to Representative Schultz because she's worked on this, and she actually was, took the deep breath and tried to wade into the dark waters here. I don't know if that's an inappropriate metaphor. It probably is, but there is a lot of controversy in this area is really all I'm saying. And so I'm going to go to her, and she may know she probably knows the number you're looking for as well. Chair Schultz.
Thank you, Chair Liebling and Senator Abler. So this was a bill brought forward by Representative Keeler and Senator Kunesh-Podein. And they're very concerned about the Office of Ombudsperson for Families. And they, in their bill, request that we create a new Office of Ombudsperson for American Indian Families. The Ombudsman Office for Families is very small. They have limited staff, and they do really important work on protecting children across the state. So they're seeing higher caseloads for American Indians and for African Americans. We're going to, try to maintain their base budget, but also we carved out additional funding for this new office, which I believe I don't have my budget spreadsheet in front of me, but I think it's $400,000. And Mr. Berg can comment after I'm done just describing what this does. So I've been involved trying to be a neutral mediator between the different ombudspersons for families and figuring out what the underlying problem is and what a solution could be. So I've spent time talking to each of them, and I'm looking forward to our conversation later today, Senator Abler, where maybe we can get to a compromise on this language since it is different in the Senate and our House bill. But I think that I've identified the problem, and I think the solution is to separate the create a new office for Ombudsperson for American Indian Families. And this is what individuals are asking for, not just legislators, but people across the state. And we've carved out money to do that.
And Mr. Berg, can you just tell us what we have on our spreadsheet for that?
Madam Chair, members, yes, the positions for the Ombudsman for Families are on line 1462 of the spreadsheet. And the Senate picks up the governor's recommendation, which includes the base for the office, which is $723,000 a year in general fund. And then it adds $31,000 in the 22-23 biennium and 42 in the tails for an operating adjustment. The House position adds an additional $483,000 from the general fund in 22-23 and $496,000 in the tails. And frankly, that's a bit of a plug number, as Representative Schultz mentioned. We put the language in and added some additional money kind of late in the process, and with the thinking of going down the road of separating the office, but the spreadsheet only has one line for the ombudsman, and so there needs to be something worked out between any language we do that would create a new office and the way we're appropriating the money and how much.
Thank you. Representative Schultz, anything more on that?
I'm happy to answer questions, but I know Senator Abler and I are going to meet today, and this is going to be on my agenda to discuss.
Well, that's great. And thank you so much again for your work on that. So I think what I'm understanding, it's kind of, should we study the issue? Because obviously this is a very thorny issue, but a super important issue, Ombudsman for Families, the work they're doing across all of the different people involved is very, very important work. And so I think what it's kind of, are we going to have to kind of study it and come back later, or are we going to be able to solve the problem in this bill? And I must say, I think if we can solve the problem in the bill, it would be much preferable to do that. Senator Abler, any other comment on this?
Well, thanks. And it would be nice to sort it out if we could. I think waiting a whole nother year for this, clearly each of the different ombuds groups that are represented here have their own challenges. The tribal ones have specific ones related to ICWA and just so many other things. So I'm happy to work on that. I just wanted to comment that you know, nearly $1 million over the 4 years may seem like that's as available as some of the Senate's positions on childcare spending. I think when the targets become more real and some of the ways that the governor has chosen to save money kind of maybe dissolve because they're not really as practical as they may seem, that $1 million might seem kind of precious. So, and so I've talked to Senator Kunesh and asked her what a zero target switch would look like, just to see how that might go, and is there other money they can bring in from somewhere else. But so I'm very friendly to sort this out. So thank you, Madam Chair. And then I have one more thing. Just I want to.
Okay,
ask
sure, Senator Abler, go ahead.
I think we're done with this. I've just got a bunch of emails about this Culture and Ethnic Communities Leadership Council. We spent no time on this at all, and it's all confidential whistleblower, and I have no idea. Can you just comment about that, Madam Chair?
Thanks, Senator Abler. I mean, I'm probably not the primary person who should be discussing this, but I the emails, I have to say, are disturbing to me because you can't, right off the bat, when somebody says confidential, whistleblower, keep this confidential, and they're sending it to lots and lots and lots of people. I don't know how to even interpret that. I mean, and frankly, it makes me somewhat, you know, it's a turnoff, to put it bluntly, to say, because then you kind of wonder what, you know, or how legitimate the whole thing is. But I, you know, obviously that there are some people who have some strong feelings about this council. And I wonder if this is the bill is being carried in the House by Representative Knorr. It seems like the concerns are a lot bigger than what is being done in the bill. But Chair Schultz, is this something that you can comment on a little more than I'm able to?
Sure. So the bill language, I know you've served Chair Liebling on this council. I believe they meet monthly. And Representative Knorr is the author of the policy change. And then there's appropriation for per diem for some of the members. But what the policy changes are is that it extends this Cultural and Ethnic Community Leadership Council. It had an end date of 2022. So it deletes that end date. It continues the council and to meet. It gives direction to the commissioner on the duties for the council. And it provides provisions on the members of the council and that they should not be missing more than 3 absences per year to be a member, and provides other provisions. But I think it's sound policy, and I'm happy to discuss this in detail with Senator Abler to see if we can get to an agreement. But in terms of the emails, since they do say confidential and private, I'm not comfortable discussing that here in public.
Senator Benson, please.
And as to the confidential whistleblower, just a reminder to the public that generally when you send something, we can't handle it as a whistleblower appropriately. And so the Office of the Legislative Auditor, if you have a whistleblower complaint, that is from the legislative side, that is a much better place because they have the ability to actually protect information. And so I've gotten copied and reply alled on these emails. And so the intensity of the conversation makes me hesitant to take abrupt action. So I'm glad that Representative Schultz has been digging into this, but some of it might need to be discussed in public as we make decisions without attribution to specific individuals.
Yeah, thank you for that, Senator Benson. And actually, I've kind of written back once or twice and said kind of just what you said, that legislators, there is no provision for legislators to keep things confidential. So when you send information to legislators, I mean, individually, of course, we can agree to keep things confidential, and I'm sure that we do all the time. But as an institution, you really can't send anything to us and have any guarantee that it's confidential. So, you know, we try to handle things as sensitively as we can, but Senator Benson, I absolutely agree that the legislative auditor can do that and we can't. So, Senator Abler.
Well, thanks. And I was just reading through, and so I'm not going to pile on much. I just found a, maybe the word amusing or something. The line 640.1 and 2, it expires when racial and ethnic based disparities no longer exist. So, so it'll be pretty soon. Anyway, just I appreciate the optimism there. Madam Chair, just one more thing I wanted to comment about the reverse auction.
Yeah, can I just say one more word about this bill?
Yeah,
let's go back to Representative Schultz.
Thanks, Chair Liebling. So I think it's important when you're, if you're a legislator and you're appointed to serve on this council, that we show up for these meetings and we be involved in these discussions, and we learn from the other council members and we listen to them. So I think if there are members appointed, please please show up to these meetings and participate. I know I will be in the future.
Yeah, thank you for mentioning that, Representative Schultz. So this is one of those councils. I think I had said to Senator Benson, I don't know if it was during the committee hearing or offline, that oftentimes, you know, I kind of like to push back when members of the legislature are appointed to all kinds of stuff, because oftentimes we don't show up. And I think it would be better to not hold that out, that we're going to show up if we really aren't going to. And this is a council that has, you know, structural membership for, and that's why I've been attending it. But, you know, quite frankly, I wasn't always attending it. And I didn't even for a long time realize I was actually appointed by virtue of my committee assignment. So, you know, just it's kind of an example of that, that where we should be attentive to where we appoint ourselves as members of the legislature and have seats on committees that we expect to attend. Because I have a feeling if we counted all of those up across everything, we'd probably have so many hours of commitment by members of the legislature that it's virtually impossible for us to do it. But besides that, there are some seats on this. I have mostly been the only legislator to actually show up for many of the meetings I've been at, which hasn't been all of them, but I do think we need to be more attentive to this. So thank you for that, Representative Schultz. What else? Sorry, Senator Abler, go ahead.
No, it's fine. No, and I appreciate that. And I know I get emails from them. Does that, I don't even know if I'm on the thing. If I'm on there and I never went, I apologize. So.
It is the chairs of the Human Services.
Is that right?
Committee. Oh. So you would be, I think, automatically appointed as chair of Human Services.
Oh, I apologize. I didn't even know. So I have a very bad attendance score, I think. Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, just a question about the competitive bidding. Was that vetted pretty well? It sounds like a Steve Swigum idea from days gone by, that back when we were doing this. Does that ring a bell, Representative Liebling? It seems like a good idea. Can you just tell me how well you've sorted it out?
So I think this has been more vetted in the Commerce Committee, I want to say. We didn't spend a lot of time on it.
Chair Liebling, so was this an amendment on the floor from Representative Abler?
No.
Albright.
I thought it was Representative, I know Representative Howard has been very involved in this. So, and I think staff is telling me it was a floor amendment. It had been discussed, but it really didn't get, in our committee, it didn't have an actual hearing. Senator Benson.
Madam Chair, so Representative Howard and I are carrying the reverse auction bill that would apply within CGIP. This was an idea that came out of the state of New Jersey, and several states are now adopting it. So there is vetted language traveling in the state gov bill. There had been discussion that once it gets into CGIP and we see how it works, that it could be expanded to public programs. And so I think Representative Albright took that idea and brought it forward. I'm not opposed to doing this, but I am not comfortable given the interactivity right now of our preferred drug list. And we haven't seen it tested and vetted in CGIP. I'd like to see that function there, get the vendor established, and then do the appropriate investigation. And so while I'm not opposed to the idea in principle, as I am an author in another bill, but I think jumping into this right now is abrupt.
Okay, and thank you. And now I'm remembering, Senator Benson, thank you for that. Okay, so the particular provision that is here as a House-only provision actually came from Representative Albright as a floor amendment.
Yeah.
And then it was amended to be permissive, which quite frankly is the way the law is now. And so it isn't really doing anything, and but, you know, allowing it, so it is permissive. So, you know, this is not probably something the House is gonna go to the mat for, quite frankly, because it doesn't do all that much. So appreciate your work on this, Senator Benson.
And Madam Chair, if we want to leave the permissive language in, that's fine. It can continue the conversation, but it was my intent to have it tested in CGIP before we started applying it in other places.
Mm-hmm. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, I think we should leave the language in because maybe the agencies could identify smaller opportunities with competitive bidding to do a reverse auction, and we could evaluate those smaller opportunities, particularly if we can't get the CGIP reverse auction through the finish line this year.
Okay, so thank you for that. So we'll put a pin in that one. Other things in this article, we are kind of really running behind. So
yes.
Maybe we should, I think we've covered the substance of this article pretty well. Any other comments on it? Okay, that being the case, let's move to, we're about 20 minutes behind where we had thought we might be. So, but this has been a very good, helpful discussion. Mr. Housewalt, we are doing House Article 10, Senate Article 11. And just give me one second here, and maybe Ms. Vang can also put that one up for us. Excellent. Okay, Mr. Housewalt.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. House Article 10 aligns with portions of Senate Article 11 and Senate Article 9. I will do my best to be brief, but it may be helpful just as we get into the discussion of the child protection topic to explain why the Senate sections are sort of split between House Article 10 and House Article 11 in a little bit of a counterintuitive way. We've called out specifically which articles the Senate language comes from. And at this point, it's more important that the language align conceptually with their corresponding proposals or topic areas, rather than to follow how the House or how the Senate initially defined the child protection versus the child protection policy article. So the document should be correct, and the corresponding language should all line up conceptually. That's why you'll see a sort of bits and pieces from various Senate articles appearing in these side by sides. So turning to the document in front of you, the first collection of sections come from Senate Article 9. These are language from a department bill, a department policy bill in the Children and Family Services area, which make various changes and clarifications and conforming changes to the statute surrounding the North Star Care Program, clarifying some eligibility matters for both kinship and relative assistance, as well as some certain definitions, and all of those specifics are called out in the side-by-side summary document as well. Those are Senate only. Next are House sections 1 to 4. These are a governor's proposal relating to the North Star program in order to achieve federal compliance. Those are House only sections. The next collection of sections, House sections 5 through 20, these are House-only provisions that would add language regarding how to assign non-caregiver sex trafficking matters in the child maltreatment system. To do that, it adds conforming language regarding sex trafficking for how to include that as a matter to be referred in the child maltreatment system. Then next, Senate Section Article 11, Section 18. This is the language related to court-appointed counsel in child protection proceedings. This language appears in the Senate article and includes the costs for that proposal in the Senate spreadsheet. This language does appear in the House Judiciary and Public Safety bill, but it does not include the money that would go with this proposal that is included in the Senate position. Then finally, the last Senate-only section, Article 11, Section 36, is a direction to the commissioner which relates to collecting data from counties regarding their implementation processes for the court-appointed counsel in child protection proceedings. That also requires a report on those implementation processes. And I do not believe that direction appears in the House Judiciary bill. And Madam Chair, that is the extent of the content in the Article 10 side by side.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Housewald. So this one that, you know, shall we have some discussion on this before we go to the next article, because the next one is also child protection related, but Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had wanted to ask about, maybe just make a note about two of the items. I know there's only five lines, my apologies, but anyway, just the court appointed counsel, I guess. I'm going to connect with Chair Becker Finn, our Judiciary Chair. I'm always advancing this in the Senate. I'm interested in. I'll just say I think this could be a really, really powerful innovation. We want to make sure that we get it right. I'm wondering which senator, if there's a senator who's worked on this issue in particular, or if it's Senator Abel who's the right kind of point of contact on the Senate side or otherwise regarding this issue.
Senator Abler.
Well, thanks. I'm the right one for now. Senator Matthews worked on this. And just to step back to the topic, it's I was shocked to, I tried to turn it off, how many people do not have representation when they're going to have their child taken away and is clearly demographically skewed into the BIPOC population, which to me is tragic because they're the ones losing their kids. And if they would have been represented, they might have said, you maybe don't want to sign that paper just yet. And so it's amazing to me. So we won't need to spend much time on that. So Senator Math, some counties do this, some do not. So this funds inadequately, I would say, but at least the counties that don't do it, just to help them to do it. So we're trying to avoid a mandate. Where they've already, the counties that elected to do this, I would say God bless them for doing the right thing. But I thought I had heard that the House requires them to do it anyway, which I am also totally fine with. Is that true, Madam Chair, that there is some House proposal that addresses this in just a cost-neutral way?
Well, my understanding is that there is language moving in the Judiciary bill on this. Chair Becker Finn is very interested in this, and I think part of the, I think we all share the concern around it that you've stated very well, Senator Abler. And my understanding is that this is part of the work of the Ombudsman for Families, is to help in these situations a little bit. But I mean, you're so right. We, you know, obviously our Constitution mandates counsel for people in situations where they face jail. And yet, and so we do that. That's what the public defender is about. And we spend quite a bit of money in that area. And we don't tell counties to do it. We fund that as a state. And it's run through the courts. And yet in this area where people are facing a court hearing, where they risk the very, very, very serious consequence of losing parental rights, we don't, as a matter of course, provide counsel. And I think what we're all struggling with is that it's a very expensive thing to do. And, you know, we haven't really figured out how to best manage it. And I think there's concern about how well counties can do this, whether the, you know, they should be tasked with this, whether it should be a state matter, whether it should be somewhat akin to what the public defender does and run through there. I mean, there are concerns about, you know, who manages attorneys and who, you know, attorneys are officers of the court. There's also a concern about shortage of attorneys who are available or even qualified to do this kind of specialized work. So there are a lot of issues here. And I know Chair Becker-Finn just put in the language because she's so committed to having this happen. But quite frankly, we just haven't figured it out yet. So, you know, we're hopefully we can figure out something here that at least gets us started. But, you know, it's just, it's a big, big issue. And I'm not, I just don't know that any of us quite have the solution right now for it. Sure, Senator Abler, and then I'll go to Senator Hoffman.
Right, and thanks, Madam Chair. But, you know, when you're ignorant, I mean, it's so easy to be ignorant of things here, and then you think, well, that's fine. Then you learn about it. You're like, you're kidding me. You know, and it's one thing to have a counselor. It's something else to have counsel. And I can't imagine charging the ombuds persons with this. They're so thin as it is with their staffing, and they're not generally lawyers, and they don't, I mean, right. they can say, oh, you better do something, you know. I hope we can address something this year. Maybe we should say you can't terminate unless they have counsel. I mean, you know, you don't send someone to jail for murder, even if they looks like they did it, without having somebody advise them about, you know, where to sign the paper, right, or whatever. But this just, but, and it seems, Madam Chair, this is going to save somebody some money. If you avoid 10 or 20% of the out-of-home placements, we're spending tons of money. And the counties eat this as much as anybody with their costs. So anyway, I'm glad you're interested. I guess I'm beyond interested. Thanks, Madam Chair.
Yeah, and, you know, Senator Abler, just to be really clear, I'm not suggesting, you know, I am an attorney. I'm not suggesting that the office, you know, can do what attorneys can do. I am very well aware of the difference. So I in no way think that they're there to represent people. Yeah. But also we have to remember, your suggestion is, you know, I'm glad we're doing some creative thinking around this, but remember on the other side of that is a child who needs permanency. And in an appropriate matter where the child really needs to be placed, just delaying the termination of parental rights could actually be disastrous too. So, I mean, this is something that's awfully delicate on both sides, maybe there are more than two sides here. You know, I'm just saying this covers a full range. So there certainly are probably some terminations that didn't have to be terminations, but my goodness, we don't want to leave kids in limbo either. So it's just a really thorny problem. Senator Abler.
So with a child who may need permanency, I'm just going to leave. And so,
yeah.
I mean, frankly, line up the Caucasians, line up the African-Americans. It's like, holy cow. I mean, they just all need permanency and these don't. Like, anyway, so I'll leave it at that. But
no, thanks, I mean,
your points are well taken. We agree.
I get it. Yeah, we don't have a disagreement of, you know, the goal here and the desire. It's just, this is one of those really thorny policy and fiscal issues of how do we get there and keep things balanced. And, you know, in this whole area of, this is a very fraught area from so many directions. It really is. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To Senator Abler's point, you know, that part of the Legislative Task Force on Child Protection that Rita Moran was co-chair with Senator Rosen, we had heard these just absolutely heart-wrenching stories. And one of the takeaways, and I'm glad to see, you know, Senator Matthews put this in, some of that was based on the discussion that was occurring in that Legislative Task Force. There's an intersectionality here, folks. There's an absolute intersectionality between the BIPOC and disability and people that were losing their children, because in one case, the woman just had no understanding of what the heck she was signing. To Senator Zabler's point, you might want to hold off on signing that until we get some help here, all right? And I think looking at that, you know, the Disability Law Center, Mid-Minnesota Legal, there's so many different avenues that we could probably go and enhance their services and their supports in order to make sure this does become an absolutely cost savings at the end. Plus, you're also upholding people's unique and individualized needs and their individual rights. And so I'm glad we had this discussion in the Senate. I'm glad to see Senator Matthews bring this forward. And again, it all goes back to And you can even go talk to Rena Moran, those heart-wrenching stories about what if I would have had somebody would have helped me understand what it is that I was signing. So thank you for having this discussion.
So just so I'm clear, what exactly is the Senate doing here then? You're putting some money toward this. Do you have an idea of, first of all, what money are you putting toward this? Is this money that is ongoing state money, or is this money that is going to be, I mean, I just genuinely don't know. And then are you covering the need, and do you know what the need is and what the cost will be? I mean, just please give me a little more on how you've decided to structure this.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know what line number it is. So maybe staff can point that out to us on the spreadsheet.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Housewald.
I believe the line in the spreadsheet is line 278.
And Madam Chair, without even looking at it, I know it's not enough money, but it's, Senator Matthews, I believe, attempted to fund the gap that exists where people have nothing. The counties that don't do anything in an effort to avoid a county burden where they don't have incurred that yet. And it's curious if the three of the numbers are 666. I don't know what that means, Madam Chair, but it does not relieve the counties of the burden where they're doing it now, which I think is the right thing to do. So that's the best I can tell you. And if you want to, I don't know how your time's going, but you know, maybe in the interim, you can talk to the department and see what they think it should be. Or if you want them to comment now, it'd be probably appropriate.
Okay, well, I don't know if they're prepared to comment on this now. And we're going to just need a lot more discussion on this, I think, about.
Thanks, Madam Chair.
Yeah. Okay. Good. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I did have the second topic, if we're done with this one, which it seemed like
Please.
We are. Thank you, which is, it's the third line of the five on our list of sections. It's the non-caregiver sex trafficking assessment. And just for folks who don't know, so I work as a prosecutor outside the legislature, and a lot of my work is focused on addressing sexual exploitation and sex trafficking. So I've done training all around the state for officers and others, and it's been a big part of my work. This is actually a proposal that I received from Senator Hoffman, fellow conferee, that he had worked on with the department, with DHS. It basically says that, and I just want to highlight this for members, that if you have a non-caregiver sex trafficker, under current child protection law, that person needs to be interviewed in a certain way that essentially just does not fit well at all these situations. It's sort of situations where you have trafficking that's occurring not by a parent or caregiver. And essentially sets up a separate process to address those situations. There is a cost of, I think, a one-time cost of $86,000 and then $14,000 a year after that, which seems like a pretty small cost for the benefit here. And I guess I just want to highlight, I don't know if my Senator Hoffman has anything that he wants to say on it as the person who I say could set the jackets to me in the first place and working on it. But I certainly hope that this is something that we could include in the end. Just want to highlight it for folks.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And absolutely, I wish we had 12 months to really work through all the stuff. I mean, you look at how many bills that we passed back and forth, Representative Pinto. And yeah, this is one of them that I'd really like to see us find some closure and support on at the end. So thanks for bringing that up.
So I'm not clear from this exchange whether there's any significant disagreement here. Is it too early to ask that question? Representative Pinto?
We have a lot of provisions to work through, so I wouldn't want to put the Senate side on the spot here, but I guess I'd be surprised if there was substantive objection at all to this. There is, as I say, a cost, but it's a pretty tiny one. So I would hope and expect there'd be agreement, but obviously we'll have to see where things go.
Okay. All right. So let's try to move on here. Oh, Senator Abler?
Well, there's one more proposal, Madam Chair, and it's relatively substantive.
Please.
It's the North Star changes. And where is that on the, is that a savings on the spreadsheet or a cost? I think it's savings.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Housewald.
It's my understanding that this is a policy package.
No, one through House language, where they change the payment rates. I'm sorry, it wasn't clear.
Yeah, Mr. Berg.
Madam Chair, I think this appears at page 209 of the spreadsheet.
Okay.
At line 209. Yeah, that's correct.
So, Madam Chair.
Do you want me to describe the House language?
Yeah, Representative Schultz, I think that'd be helpful. So
in the House only language, this is to do federal compliance with this North Star Kinship Program. And what it does, it removes the offsets. It removes the offsets for disability, retirement survivors, disability insurance, veterans benefits, railroad retirement benefits, and Black lung benefits.
Okay, yeah, so, right. So just to be, thanks for that. And so just, you know, for people who aren't in the weeds on this, which is probably most of us, as I'm understanding, Representative Schultz, correct me if I'm wrong. So right now, the benefits that the families get have offsets by these other benefits that might be coming to the child. And federal law does not allow us to make those offsets.
That's correct.
So that's why this is in there. And does anybody want more on that? I don't know if the department, if we need more right now, the department might be able to help us. Senator Abler?
Well, thanks. And so is this different than changing the rates? This is a different section than that. Is that right? There's a rate change for North Star that maybe the governor did that the Senate did not do. I'm getting a lot of emails about how Senate's crushed. Is that a different topic than this?
That's not in this article.
That's in a different article.
Yeah, and I think this is an increase, right? This is a cost to the state because it does not allow us to count these other payments against what we would otherwise be paying the families. So, Mr. Greenman,
we didn't work on this at all. So,
okay, I saw Mr. Greenman came on for a second. Mr. Greenman, can you give us just a moment on this?
Madam Chair, Dave Greenman with the Department of Human Services. You're correct. What this does is it eliminates certain offsets that we had in state law. And the reason is, as you said, is that federal law doesn't allow us to take those offsets. We've already stopped doing those offsets going forward, and that's why there's no cost beyond fiscal year 22. What this essentially does is it goes back, it tells us to go back and renegotiate payments to those families that had their rates reduced back to, I think, 2015. And so we would have to go back essentially and repay the amounts that we reduced through the offset. Going back in time.
And Mr. Greenman, that's because the feds are requiring us to do that?
That's right.
Okay. And if we fail to do that piece of federal compliance, is there a penalty for that or, you know?
Well, we are under a performance improvement plan, which is a federal way of saying you need to fix this or else. I don't know. I'm not sure we know yet what the or else is, but I mean, they have the ability to withhold payments from us for other things. And so I think it's probably a good thing to fix.
All right, thank you. Senator Abler.
Well, and thanks. So I thought I was clear, but now you mentioned, Mr. Green, you mentioned going forward, but this isn't the payment issue. Is this the payment issue as well that we're getting notes about that there was, I've got a ton of emails about this. Is this a different matter than those where the people are concerned their rates are going to go down for doing their family foster care?
Oh, Senator, this is not family foster care. Oh. Mr. Greenman, please correct me if I'm wrong. I believe this is completely different.
Madam Chair, Senator Abler, no, this is a different issue.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate that. Thanks, Madam Chair, that's all I got.
All right, thank you. Thanks, members. Can we then move on to Article 11? And I think there's a lot in Article 11 too, so I don't know if we're gonna get through everything, but that is the last one on our list for today, if we can move on there. And so Mr. Housewald is going to present that one for us, Article 11.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will endeavor to be brief. Madam Chair and members, starting at the top of the shared document in front of you, I think it's about to come up. Yep, there it is. So House Section 1, this section includes some technical and clarifying changes relating to children's residential treatment placement. This language appears in two places in the side-by-sides in order to call out specifically what are the technical changes and what would be some different substantive changes that appeared in the behavioral health side-by-side. The substantive changes appear in the behavioral health side-by-side article, House Article 12, Section 6, compared with Senate Article 11, Section 3. So this section is just policy technical clarifying changes so that they can be discussed independently here. Next, House Sections 2 through 8 line up with Senate sections from Article 11. These are the same language with technical differences only. It relates to language for the Family First implementation project. Specifically, these are definitional changes that would incorporate some updated terminology from Family First. Next, House Sections 9 and 10 align with Senate Article 11, Sections 11 and 12. Again, Family First implementation language relating to children's residential facilities, foster residence settings, provider certification requirements. And the language is the same aside from some technical differences. Next, House Sections 11, 12, and 19. They align with Senate sections from Article 11, Sections 13, 14, and 21. These also relate to Family First, but these are about establishing lead tribal contracts, which would be a parallel to what are known as lead county contracts that contemplate contracting for placement of children, I believe, across county lines or between a county and a tribe. And the language is largely the same, aside from minor technical differences and one conforming change that the Senate makes, but the House does not. Next is Senate-only language, Article 12, Sections 1 and 2. These are from a governor's proposal regarding how to report child support non-cooperation and how to appeal a non-cooperation decision regarding non-cooperation for paying child support. Next, Senate Sections, Article 9, 36, 38, and 40 through 48. This is a collection of sections that again come from that Department Children and Family Services policy bill, which relate to modifications and clarifications regarding child safety and permanency, as well as some of the adoption statutes. And rather than take more time here, I'll point out that those sections are more specifically described in the shared summary document. We'll move on to the next page, starting with House Section 13. This is House only. This is a section that would amend the definition of child in need of protection or services to increase the age from 10 to 13 for children who commit a juvenile petty offense or delinquent act. Next, the next collection of sections, House Sections 14 to 18, 20 through 26, and 37, they align with parallel language from Senate Article 11. This is more Family First implementation language. Technical and clarifying updates, spelling out additional requirements for QRTP placement procedures, as well as modifications to the successful transition to adult provisions. And again, this language is similar with some technical and phrasing differences. Next, House Sections 27 and 28 through 32 align with parallel language in the Senate from Article 11. Again, Family First implementation, but specifically the topic is how to incorporate Family First into the 260D foster care settings. Again, similar and same language with some technical and phrasing differences. Next, House Section 33 aligns with Senate Sections Article 12, Section 3, and Section 4. These are different proposals, but relate to how to include youth recreation program workers in as mandatory reporters. And the differences are that the House's language has a slightly broader scope with which employees would be included as mandatory reporters, and the Senate includes a provision that would require counties to provide training to mandatory reporters. Next, House Section 34 aligns with Senate Article 12, Section 5. This is language that would permit a delay in having the face-to-face contact with a child that's the subject of a child protection report. The language is similar, just has some technical phrasing differences. Next, House Section 35 aligns with Senate Article 19, Section 3. And this is language that exempts healthcare professionals from reporting on prenatal substance use cases, and the language is the same. House Section 36 is House only. This is a provision that would require a parent to be notified of any contested case hearing for appeals of maltreatment determinations, giving parents the right to file a written statement and to attend and participate in the hearing. That's House only. Next are a few Senate-only provisions. This is Senate Article 12, Sections 6 and 7. These are modifications to the Child Support Parent Education Program, which I believe is a program that is operated by the court system to educate parents when they're subject to a child support procedure. Next, Article 12, Section 8, 20 through 25 from the Senate. These are more modifications to child support policy that would remove interest charging requirements on child support judgments, and specifically state that interest does not accrue on those judgments. Next, Senate Article 12, Sections 9 through 18, more child support modifications, altering the child support guidelines, deductions, calculations, child support or child care support obligations, and adjustments for increased income, reporting arrears, to consumer reporting area agencies, things like that. Those are all Senate-only provisions. So turning to page 3, Senate Section 19, Article 12, Section 19, this is a governor proposal regarding post-judgment child support custody parenting time, how to transfer a parenting time or custody action to the tribal courts. This is Senate-only. Next, House Section 38 aligns with Senate Article 11, Section 37. This is a direction to the commissioner to consult with stakeholders to develop transitional aftercare supports for when children are transitioning out of a qualified residential treatment placement. This is a similar language with technical differences. Next, Senate Article 11, Section 38 is Senate only. Direction to the commissioner to evaluate the any increased costs to the state, counties, and providers that are associated with conforming to the provider certification requirements under the Family First program. Senate Article 11, Section 39 is next. This is also Senate only. The direction to the commissioner for a study of how to reorganize the Ombudsperson for Families office. You'll recall that the House proposal that corresponds with this would actually establish the Office of the Ombudsperson for American Indian Families as a standalone and distinct office, as you discussed from the miscellaneous side-by-side. House Section 39 is a reviser instruction to add a head note relating to QRTP placement. That's House only. And then finally, Senate Article 11, Section 40 is a repealer that repeals statutes that are made unnecessary under the Family First implementation conforming changes. This repealer does appear just in a different article for the House. It appears in their behavioral health side-by-side, but it is the same. And Madam Chair, that's the walkthrough.
All right, well, thank you very much, Mr. Housewald. Appreciate that. And so just to note, this is a lot in this particular article, just by volume alone, but a lot of substance too. Senator Abler. Oh, you're muted. Hey, that's the first time I've had to say that this whole hearing.
That's pretty good, thanks. So you really do want to hear what I have to say, Madam Chair? Thank you for that. That's, well, maybe you have no choice, I don't know. There's
comment.
A lot of agreement. There's a lot of agreement, and the Family First in particular takes a lot of pages. And so this was Senator Bigham worked a lot on this. And so whoever your lead is, if they want to sort out with that on this, but there is I don't want to get into any of that except to say that the Senate attempted to relieve the county share on some of these important workarounds with the Family First and who's included and excluded and where they get to be served and all that. and so providing for a full range. I have a feeling at the end, the money's gonna shrink down much closer to the governor's numbers. And so if whoever is gonna work on that would talk to Representative Bigham, about how that might land to be as kind as it could be, that would be nice. Just a couple other questions I have. So there's some house only provisions about House 13 and House 36. Just looking at the titles of those are probably complicated, but was that part of, where did those come from? Advocates or?
Okay, so
I 13 and 36.
Okay, so Senator Abler, I see Representative Schultz has her hand up, but I think some of this would be probably Representative Pinto as well. So I think just looking at the 13 that has the age shift, I think that's a corollary probably to something that Representative Pinto, but let me go to Representative Schultz first.
Sure, Chair Liebling, thank you. And Senator Abler, yes, Section 13, Representative Pinto can talk to, that's his bill. But Section 36 is a bill from constituents of Representative Cagle. She brought this bill forward. We heard it in Human Services Finance in the House, and it requires to notify parents if there's a contested case hearing, because we heard some grandparents and parents came to notify us that that wasn't the case. So this makes sure that they're made aware of it so they can attend those cases and when they're appealing a maltreatment determination. So it's a fairly simple bill, not that very complex. I encourage you to read it and then we can discuss it, Senator Abler.
Thank you.
And then I will connect with Senator Bingham on the Family First. Remember, this is to be in federal compliance. There's an effective date. The counties have concerns about getting the QRTPs, residential treatment programs, certified. There is money in the agency is setting aside to get more providers certified, but counties are concerned about the date, and I'll work with Senator Bingham on that language.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Chair Schultz. And let's go to Chair Pinto to talk about that other piece that Senator Abler asked about.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Senator Abler. I'll just note, just regarding Section 36 that Chair Schultz just referenced, just to confirm that I think it really is consistent with some of the comments Senator Abler had made before about ensuring the rights of parents in these situations. It's a real small point, but I think an important one. The parents should at least get notified as these hearings are occurring. So I know we'll continue to talk about them. Regarding Section 13, I appreciate the chance to highlight that actually. So what this provision does, our delinquency, the shift from a child being treated, you know, if a six-year-old who does something that would, if committed by an adult, would be a crime potentially or a wrongdoing, we recognize that that's a child protection issue, right? That's an issue of the child where you've got parental responsibility and other situations. As the age increases, we have this shift over. And currently, if you have a 10-year-old child, and again, I'm speaking as a prosecutor, from my work in that role, that child is sent to the juvenile delinquency system rather than situations being treated as child protection, which is what they really should be. What this proposal does is to shift that age up to the age of 13. I think we have an understanding that as we have kids who are 13-year-old and up, we do have that shift to adulthood. I want to make sure, of course, we're being careful about that as well. We do have the delinquency system, but boy, if a child is 10, 11 years old, we want that child to be have the situation addressed in the child protection system, and that's what this proposal would do. And it was worked out with the Department of Corrections as well. And I'm happy to talk more about it, but that's the genesis of it, Senator Abler.
Thanks, Madam Chair.
Senator Abler.
And so did that go, I don't even know where our jurisdictions are in the Senate, but at the end, there was nobody concerned about it?
Representative Pinto.
Madam Chair, Senator Abler, let me think. So first of all, the provision was heard in our Public Safety Committee as well. There are a number of reforms in this area. This particular provision is the only one directly related to child protection, so it's in this bill. And I would say that I think in general, there was support yeah, I'm trying to sort of characterize the, I think there's concern about just making sure that, you know, we want to set the right age. Some of our Republican colleagues raised some questions about that. But I think in general, the thought that 10 is, that starting at age 10 for delinquency instead of child protection is really not an appropriate thing to do. I guess, I think it's a fair characterization of the reaction of colleagues as we had hearings on this.
Thanks. And Madam Senator Chair, Liebling to you on this. So if you could help us assemble a list of things that we should probably run through some of our other people that haven't been consulted on this to see if they're, everybody doesn't work on all the same things. These seem meritorious, but it would help me if there's house-only provisions that are of this ilk that I can run up the flagpole. Thank you.
Okay, I'm not sure how to respond to that, Senator. I'm not really sure what staff.
I'll just ask my staff to work on that.
So could you, maybe you could restate that. So are you, you're looking to, I mean, it's, could maybe just restate it if you would.
Well, thanks. Madam Chair, you said some of this, like some of this went to public safety and so on. And so there are some real interests, at least in one particular chair whose name starts with an L, just to know what's going on. And so I think that would be a good idea for me to shop that to all these interested other chairs. And so then it's, I'm just asking staff since we're on the call here to kind of give me a list and then we'll take it up.
Okay, a list of things that you might want to consult with a particular senator on?
Well, and other senators as well.
Okay. Okay. So, okay. Senator Abler, I would not want to get involved in that. Just let me be very clear. I'm not giving you the list.
We're going to schedule you a meeting. Yeah.
Senate Council, I'm sure, will help you.
Yeah, Madam Chair. 2 p.m. Okay, thanks.
All right. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And yeah, I too will stay out of that, except to just note, I may have been a little bit misleading in my comment about Section 13 then, and that part of the reason it was heard in that other committee was simply because there were several provisions that were all advanced and the other provisions really related to that area. I think there'd be a pretty good argument that this is really a child protection issue and so falls in the human services area. So I don't want to have us be thrown off by this. The reason it got heard in the other area is really more because of the other provisions that happen to be sitting with, none of which are in this bill. So that may make things a little bit easier regarding this one at least. Thanks.
Representative Schultz.
I'd just like to add to that. So there was an outpouring of emails to make sure that I included this piece of that larger bill in human services. So that's why this piece is included in our bill, because so many people had contacted me directly to make sure this was included because it's a priority.
So it sounds to me, correct me if I'm wrong, but it sounds to me like this might be kind of in the category of something else we talked about earlier, that we're more likely to be able to resolve it and move forward here, something that might arguably have different jurisdictions, but that, you know, if we are viewing this issue as a child protection issue, that it belongs here, that we could resolve it here if members feel that that is something that we all want to do. Am I kind of characterizing this right?
I think, Madam Chair, if I can, I actually think this might be an example that's sort of even more than that, that it's not even this particular provision. I'm not even sure that there really is a joint jurisdictional issue. Mm-hmm. I think it is pretty firmly in our area. It just happens, as I say, that it was traveling with some other provisions that were in other areas. So this particular one, although there's a lot of the, there's a number of other issues I can think of where there is, I think in the early childhood areas I've been working in where there's provisions in the Senate HHS bill and House Education, we need to figure all that out. But regarding this one, I think it actually is much more squarely and fully just in our jurisdiction and not in other ones.
Well, let me ask you this then, Representative Pinto, and I'm not actually looking at the language. So, you know, just going off of what's here in the summary, say we were to adopt this provision and it becomes law and the other corollary changes to the juvenile jurisdiction doesn't get passed because that piece wouldn't be in our bill, then would we be doing dual jurisdiction for children in this age group or would it confuse anything?
No, Madam Chair, and I'm sorry, I think I may have, no, the other provisions have really nothing to do with this provision, except that they were also related to, they came out of the department. So the other ones have to do with, strip searches of children who were in custody, and solitary confinement. But those are all things for children in custody and really would not be. So no, there's really no direct connection to this at all. This could easily become law. The other things wouldn't. And this still would have force. It's really unrelated. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, thank you for that. And boy, that context for this is actually pretty chilling when you think about it. You know, if that's happening to children and who get put into the juvenile system, how terrifying is that to think of children, you know, 10, 11, 12 years old being subjected to those kinds of things instead of being subjected or being handled as children in need of protection and services, which they surely are if they're in that situation. So, oh, thank you for bringing that up. Okay. Other things on this article. We have 15 minutes left in the hearing, so we have covered a lot of ground today, and I think Senator Benson and I are going to need to do a lot of work offline to try to figure out how to move us forward here, because I think this conference committee, we should have team colors for this conference committee. We are just charging ahead on so many difficult issues, and we've got so much work to do. Senator Abler?
Madam Chair, we all get white hats. That's all I know.
There we go.
And at the end, we should have halos. But this is, I think it's going well. I want to just commend you and Chair Benson for the tone of the discussion so far. We are going to have some challenges, I think, hitting our target. But I just wanted to announce for your sake and others that I've chatted with Senator Utke, and he's going to be taking the lead on the substance use stuff. And in the background, will be Senator Hoffman and myself, but at least the principal contact could be with that. And maybe Senator Benson has a similar announcement on something else.
Madam Chair, Senator Utke has agreed to take point on background checks. And obviously I have a deep interest, as do you, in getting that done. And so we can check in on those items.
Oh, that's terrific. Thank you. Thank you very much for that. Okay. All right. Was there anything else we needed to cover right now on House Article 11, Senate Article 12? Okay, not seeing anything. So really, well, great. So we can kind of do our closing up things here, which we've kind of started to do. So that's terrific. And so Senator Benson, let me, if you're ready, let me just kind of turn it over to you for any thoughts that you have. And well, before I do that, actually, just to say that, you know, I don't know what you have planned for tomorrow. I'm trying to get together something around what we talked about with Representative Vang and that whole issue about the diverse workforce mental health provisions. So anyway, Senator Benson.
Thank you. And Chair Liebling, I was thinking that might be good for when you have the gavel again on Wednesday. That will give you the opportunity to script that. And I haven't talked with you, and so I don't want to announce publicly some of the things that I'm thinking of. So I'm going to have staff check in with you. We do plan to have a hearing tomorrow and get information out. We've walked through all the articles, and so now we're going to have to start going through some of the thornier issues and making commitments to direction or just setting them aside. And regardless of target, we're going to have some things that need to be worked out. And so I wanted to talk with you before I made a public announcement.
Okay, well, that's excellent. Yeah, we are kind of at a change point here, having gone through. There is a Senate Article 7 that we haven't, and I'm not sure it's necessary for us to go through, and that would be up to you, of course. And then the appropriations article, which we probably wouldn't be well served to go through that. So it's not that we've gone through every little piece, but we've probably gone through what we need to. But we will definitely talk offline and try to figure out where we go from here. And that would be great. So anything else that members need to cover? Yeah, Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll note, I think, and I can look at this separately, but I think that there may be a fair amount. I know that in the area of early learning and care, there's a fair amount in that appropriation article that we may or may not have talked about. I guess I'll take a look at that. But there's a number of places where the House, I think, made decisions that aren't reflected in the rest of the articles. I guess I'll take a look at that, Madam Chair, and maybe let you and Senator Benson know. But that might be one exception to the idea that, well, that's just where we put the money on all the other articles we talked about. There may be some things that are only in that article with regard to at least some things. And I'll just note in that regard that the federal spending, of course, regarding the money that is directly allocated to childcare is not affected by our budget target discussions. So I'm reaching out to Senator Abler and figuring that we can probably have some conversations about that in parallel, but don't need to be on the same timeline as waiting for targets from our leaders, since it's, you know, directly allocated. So anyway, just those are two notes I just wanted to highlight. Thanks.
All right. Well, thank you very much. And I, you know, that does kind of remind me to invite members, you know, all the members of this conference committee. I just really appreciate everybody, you know, everybody's work. And if there are, you know, this bill is very large. Obviously, it covers a lot of different topics and a lot of them are complex. And so having everybody's eyes on it is very, very helpful. And if there are things that Senator Benson and I, you know, may not be aware needs to be worked out, or, you know, just please let us know. And, you know, really appreciate everybody's hard work. So with that, anything else we need to talk about before we sign off for today? Going once, going twice. All right, everybody's had enough after almost 3 hours. Thank you again to all of the staff for all of your hard work on this, and including agency staff and partisan staff and nonpartisan staff. I mean, everybody I know is working extremely hard to make all of this work. So hope everyone can enjoy the rest of your day. And with that, we are adjourned.